Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. Be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
Thank you for once again coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find us on the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com, and also check out the website where you can see a list of all of our guests here on Bard's Logic Political Talk by going to www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. And you can also find our give page, which has some wonderful organizations on there that can really use your help and would be much appreciated by them and myself. And of course, there's also the affiliates page, which of course, the more you help them, the more they will help out the show. And so tonight we have a special guest. We don't see him on the line yet, but he'll be in between now and about quarter after, so we'll see how close to the top of the beginning of the show he will come on. But our guest is tonight, constitutional conservative, a Republican 2016 presidential candidate, John Dumais. So, of course, join me, the host, and our panelists tonight, which hopefully we'll hear from James Neighbors and also from Cindy Todd, who is now in Texas. So we'll be waiting for her to come back there. Sometimes she'll be able to listen in or call in from there. And, of course, we'll have one later, Kelly Mordecai, who is our constitutional scholar. I'm sure we'll have some very interesting questions for our guest, as well as our contributor, Dan Gray, who I'm sure will have some great questions for him as well. So give us a call and be on the line for your questions to our guest tonight at 347-945-7428. And, of course, join the roundtable discussion. And here's part of his mission from our guest tonight, and he says, I will restore this great land back to the Constitutional Republic as our forefathers intended. It is so beautifully simplistic, yet our country has been turned into a complicated liberal agenda whereby your rights and those of your children and their children are ever so subtly being stripped away one by one. There are many wrongs that must be righted. Immigration, border security, ending the Federal Reserve, abolishing the IRS, stopping the NSA from spying on law-abiding citizens, returning all aspects of the First and Second Amendments back to their purest form, ending voter fraud, repealing the Affordable Health Care Act, returning our nation back to the system of government as intended by our forefathers. He continues, a system that has worked and succeeded and prevailed for over 237 years isn't insurmountable. It is the simple and correct thing to do, and it can be done by restoring hope to the American people. Our hope is that we can truly be a United States where people have been only doubt and uncertainty for a very long time. The hope that we will recover economically, the hope that we can be truly the United States, the hope that we, the will of the people, by the people, and for the people will be adhered to once and for all, and the hope that the career politicians, which our guest is not, will be forced to do the will of the people as intended, and the hope that a common man who loves his country has no agenda to bear other than this, to hope with no change to the Constitution. Now, isn't that what we've all been seeking? And, of course, folks, Bard's logic is the grassroots, we the people shall. And so I do not see our guest in the queue as of yet, so we will be bringing on one of our panelists and the contributor, Dan Gray. So we'll open up your mic. Dan, thank you very much for coming to the show. How are you?
Oh, tired as usual, but feeling very, very, very optimistic and positive. As a matter of fact, I just spent the evening not with a national organization or a statewide group. I was down at the firehouse, the hosey, as we call it, because that's where we keep the hoses, with a bunch of my neighbors who are local patriots here in Schuylkill Township. And it was a planning and coordination session for trying to, for actually taking back our township. And one of the fellows there, he's been looking, a real good researcher on YouTube and on all kinds of other sources, and he's been finding that what we're doing, although you won't see any much mention of it in the press, is actually happening across the entire country. This grassroots movement that you're talking about on Bard's Logic is truly grassroots, and the fire is growing. Everywhere you look, there are people who are just tired, and they're standing up on their hind legs and they're saying, enough. One of the other fellows who was there last night, we had a number of very nice ladies too, all ages represented, all backgrounds, and they said, you know what, it's time that the little people have a voice. And I reminded him that it's not that we're little people. It's that those people in charge are not big. They're no better than us. And they're giving us the standard, you know, crap, excuse my French, that, you know, we get everywhere else.
Oh, no,
they haven't said, well, they haven't said that they've lost the hard drives, that the emails are irretrievably lost. But we've got to put in Freedom of Information Act requests just to find out stuff that they're doing with our money. This is a township. It's a small area with a small number of people. And they're acting just like those people in Washington. We ask them nicely for an accounting of our money, just simply an accounting. And we showed them what some other townships and boroughs were doing, where they would show every amount of money that came in and where it came from and the amount, and every check that went out and what it was for, and the balance left over. And you can do the math very easily, even if you're not a CPA. And they said, well, we're not going to do that because we don't have to do that. Well, I've mentioned to our listeners before that last year when the quality of life ordinances made their way to our little township, you know, Agenda 21 light, that's what galvanized resistance. That's what finally made people realize they have their nose in our business too much. And we did get a new candidate who's brand new, and really he's an honest, decent guy, and he's not really sure what to do about everything yet, but he's honest, and he's got integrity, and that's what matters. So we're trying to help him out, and we got him elected by one vote, but it's two to one. There's three members of the supervisor board there, and they're fighting those other two on every single thing. And you got to ask yourself when you see the IRS and the scandals and of Benghazi and Fast and Furious and gosh, so many other things that we are aware of. You've got to ask, where there's smoke, is there fire? And here in this township, I'm pretty sure that nobody is, dealing arms to Al-Qaeda. In fact, I would say categorically that's beyond the realm of possibilities. And I'm pretty sure that they're not targeting constitutional and Tea Party groups. And I'd be willing to bet that they're not cavorting with Mexican drug lords. However, if they won't tell us what they're doing, it makes you wonder, what are they doing? I was reminding the people that, you know, that fellow and lady who are in office that aren't cooperating with the people, they may not be corrupt in the sense of taking money. Maybe they're not. We shouldn't assume that's true until and if we find actual evidence of wrongdoing. Maybe they're just full of themselves, and they think that they own us, that they run things because they deserve it. Then again, maybe they are taking money, and you think, what's a township got? I mean, we have a pretty hefty reserve for a small township, but it's still not millions of dollars. And you think back at all the politicians who have been caught with their hands in the money jar, in the cookie jar,
mm-hmm.
and they usually get caught, just like Al Capone did, for something small, and you think, well, how can you put somebody away for something like that? How could they sell their office? How could they buy a politician? How could they do that for just a few hundred or a few thousand dollars? And I'm reminded of the Crazy Eddie commercials that we used to have in the eastern part of the United States for a crooked businessman who basically bankrupted his business, and he said, how can we afford to do it? Volume. And that's really the key. So I'm really anxious to hear Mr. Dumais' views on things. So while we're waiting, I figured I'd fill you in and also remind our listeners that wherever you live, unless you're living in a very rare part of this country, you're living in the same place that I'm living. You're living in a place where people who you elected, who should be accountable to you, instead insist that you be accountable to them for every little thing, but that they don't have to answer a question. When's the last time you went to your city council, your township, your borough council? When's the last time you went to one of their meetings? When's the last time you actually got a candidate, supported a candidate, and elected a candidate who was not an incumbent? When's the last, and this is not Democrat or Republican, folks. We have both here, and they're our neighbors and friends. If they're honest, we're fine with them. We really don't care about that. But when's the last mm-hmm. time that you actually took initiative? Now, Mr. Dumais, he's going to be running for the President of the United States, which is an amazing, powerful, high office for anybody to run for that, no matter who they are. They have to have such a combination of money and attention and message and charisma and integrity. They have to have so much just to be in the race, much less to win that race. And Senate, that's hard, you know, trying to take back the Senate for constitutionality now. And Congress, mm-hmm. we're still talking about races where people spend literally $10 million. And there are tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people who are actually involved, even though congressional districts aren't quite that large. Or maybe they are. Kelly would know. Yeah,
we do have Kelly on the line, so why don't we go ahead?
Well, let me just finish up, and we'll turn it right over to him.
Go ahead.
When you look at your local race, this is not esoteric stuff, folks. This is where you live. This is your garbage bill. This is who plows your streets and trims the trees. This is the people who you call when there's a pothole in front of your house. These are your neighbors. And if you're not involved with them, what the heck are you going to get involved with? Seriously, you really can influence this. You have friends and family in your neighborhood, and if you've just moved in, you can make friends. People who you barbecue with, people who you sit out on the porch with on a nice summer evening, people who are just like you, and you've got a real vested interest in getting to know them and working with them to try and clean up things on a grassroots level, because that's your home. Because we're not talking the state capital. We're not talking the county capital. We're certainly not talking Washington, D.C. here. Those efforts, those fights, I'm involved with them. They're very important. We're talking where you live, where your house is, where your car is parked, where your children are. If you can't get involved in that, quite frankly, I'm ashamed of you. And with that,
and Dan,
let's
I
hear
have
what Kelly has to say.
There. Sorry, Kelly, we're going to bring in, but of course we'll bring in later on the show, but our guest, John Dumais, who is running for the 2016 Republican presidential candidate, and that's Mr. Dumais. Mr. Dumais, thank you for coming into the show. How are you?
Well, thank you very much for having me. I feel wonderful.
Awesome. And we'll just get right to it because we've got a lot of questions, and we've got plenty
sure.
of time, though, to answer them. And, of course, the format we have here is you've got as much time as you'd like to spend on answering each of these questions. And so we'll start off with the first one. And I want to talk about how you ran for president in 2010 on the Republican ticket as a write-in candidate and receiving 7 electoral votes. So tell us about the campaign. So definitely. Tell us about the campaign, how you received the 7 electoral votes, and what do you think about how the Republican leadership acted in getting Romney the nomination?
Well, actually, I knew exactly what was going to happen when Romney got the nomination. It's just the same thing when, you know, John McCain ended up getting it. I knew we were had the second it happened, only because I knew the lay of the land and knew it was going to. I just knew it was going to happen. But I basically got involved in running for politics to actively pursue Barack Obama in the courts of law. But to elaborate on that ever for you?
Started in 2012. Yeah, go ahead. You can.
In 2005. Okay, that's fine. Yeah, I'll just give you a chance. You ask me any questions that you want to ask. So, anyway, 2005, I happened to be listening to a campaign speech given by Hillary Clinton, and it was during the primaries. And it was like pulling teeth to me, like going to the dentist, you know, listening to, you know, any Democratic, you know, speech being given out, because I want to run into the bathroom to throw up more than I want to do anything else. But I had to listen to it to kind of figure out what was going on, to figure, you know, who we are up against and all that good stuff. But, Hillary Clinton happened to say the words, and believe me, I pay attention when I hear people talking. She said that Barack Obama was not qualified to be president as opposed to eligible. I mean, eligible as opposed to qualified. And, of course, that stuck in my head really, you know, real hard, because I was wondering, well, why isn't he eligible? I mean, we kind of figure he's qualified because supposedly he was a United States senator. And therefore, he should, you know, have something going for him to where he could run for president. Well, I decided to look into it, and I did. I did quite a bit of work. Did a lot of legwork, a lot of reading. I was a constitutional historian. While I went to San Diego State University, I used to, just for fun, take every history class I could, but I ended up majoring in constitutional history, which was more of a lark than anything else, because I really enjoyed listening to or reading about past court cases and the reason what shaped the foundation of this country, what shaped our law. And anyway, I stuck on the eligibility question about the President of the United States, and of course I had been hearing around, you know, here and there and all that kind of stuff, that Barack Obama wasn't eligible because of, you know, some his actual citizenship status. So that's what actually got me involved in running for president. Because if you remember right at that time, Wiley Drake and Alan Keyes were running on the independent ticket. They actually filed a lawsuit against Barack Obama against his eligibility after the election. And, of course, the court shut him down saying the election was over, it was too late, there was nothing they could do about it. And, of course, I was interested, okay, well, what could be done about it? I mean, where there's a will, there's a way. And so I immediately got an attorney and went to the court system and asked for a decision. What could I do to get legal standing in order to go after Barack Obama on his eligibility issue? So the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, I was waiting patiently. There was my attorney was Gary Creep of the United States Justice Foundation. And, of course, he was involved quite a bit with the eligibility issue of Barack Obama, but he didn't really have anybody that could stand up for him to go after Barack Obama. So we are waiting around for an actual written opinion, and I got sick and tired of waiting for the actual opinion because an in dicta opinion, and an in dicta opinion means that the court just gets together and they kind of informally say what they think someone would have to be in order to challenge Barack Obama, and one of those was the person would have to be running for president of the United States. So therefore, voila, I become a presidential candidate. And then that's when we filed the lawsuit against Barack Obama on the eligibility standing. And that was with him not being a natural-born citizen. And, of course, there's a big can of worms about that, but it's quite simple to understand as far as that goes. But that's what got me involved. And after the first time of running around, I did so well, I said, well, heck, it looks like the people of the United States are really clamoring for somebody out there that they could really stand up for the people instead of just their own selves, their own pocketbook. And I said, well, hey, I'm a United States citizen. I've been living in this country 50-something years. Why don't I do something about it? And I did. So there's the long and short of it.
Well, that's awesome. And so two things. One is you got 7 electoral votes. Tell us a little bit more about that. And then back to the – and then after that, back to how Romney got the nomination. I mean, there's those of us, especially folks who have been listening to the show for quite some time, you know, pretty much think that the Republican Party, especially the leadership, especially during the convention, really pushed for him to be the nomination, even doing some things that someone – think is underhanded in order to get there.
Oh, absolutely. If there was ever a truer Manchurian candidate in this world, I don't know of one. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Oh, if you want me to expand on it, you just let me know. I keep going. Trust me. Well, anyway, as far as Barack Obama goes, here's the deal with the Republican Party. They knew George Soros and a bunch of other a lot of communist Marxist leaders had actually groomed Barack Obama from the get go to be president of the United States, and that basically was done to usher in the new world order. I call it the Star Trek world order, you know, where everybody is doing, you know, all the no money and no more unemployment and all that good stuff, more government control, less responsibility, less people having to, you know, deal with their own, you know, things they do wrong. You know, no, there's absolutely no accountability for anything that you were doing in this country. So it seemed to me what they did, and a lot of people don't realize this, but the very first go around with you know, John McCain, they actually had to sign a bill in the House in Congress that granted him the ability to run for president of the United States. See, now, I'm a military brat from San Diego. I grew up down there in a little town called Coronado. And all my friends and my family were involved in the military from the get-go. And the one thing that we always knew was in order to be a natural-born citizen, all we had to be was born in the United States or be born in a hospital overseas with our parents if our father or mother happened to be, you know, in service while overseas. Well, the thing with John McCain was is he was born in Panama City. He wasn't actually born on a United States military base. So they actually had to pass a law stating that he was eligible, and they kind of they actually did make it where you had to be just born on the base with parents that are serving in the military. Therefore, here we go. John McCain's eligible to run for president of the United States. Now that left it open for anybody questioning Barack Obama, saying that he would be eligible. And I think that was a deal that was planned out between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party to get Barack Obama to run. Now, see, it's my contention, and I think you'd be really kind of hard-pressed to find too many Americans that don't believe the same way that I do. But as far as I'm concerned, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are exactly the same animal.
We're getting a lot of families in that here on the show.
Yeah. Well, they've created themselves an oligarchy. And I liken them
to
I've likened them to a tag team wrestling team, to where they take turns being president or controlling, you know, the different parts of the government in order to keep control of we the people, you know, to keep us under their thumb, manage to keep their positions of power, keep their wealth, whatever, what have you. And that's what they've been doing now for quite some time. And I think, you know, you could probably run it back to Roosevelt. At least back that far, maybe a little bit further back than that, but not too much further. But the Republican Party, really, they, like Ronald Reagan had said, and matter of fact, I as a little digression, when I was 12 years old, I had the opportunity to meet Ronald Reagan. As a 12-year-old, we were on a science trip or a field trip to the United States. I'm not the United States Capitol, the idiot. The Sacramento Capitol building here in Sacramento. And back then, security wasn't like it was nowadays. You know, right now, you can't walk anywhere without somebody looking at you funny. But back then, walking through the Capitol, a couple scamps just taking off from the rest of the group, and nobody even batted an eyelash. But we happened to wander into an office building, and sitting at a desk, of course, was, well, unbeknownst to us at the time, was Ronald Reagan. But, you know, we kind of dawned upon us, you know, after a bit that we were talking to Ronald Reagan. We caught on to it, and he finally let on to, you know, who we were. But he spent about 45 minutes with us, you know, talking to us about what we thought about the government, you know, what we thought about being Americans, what we wanted to do when we grew up and all that kind of stuff. And then when we left, he gave us a signed copy of the California Constitution. And, of course, the California Constitution just isn't one little single piece of paper, you see. It's a big, big, huge book. And that's what got me kind of interested in politics. Yeah, it's real interesting. I mean, I think they put about 1,000 new laws every year on the books in California. It's unbelievable out here how it runs there. But I met him then, and it kind of stuck with me from then on. And I just became conservative. I thought his idea of what government should be, you know, it was really the ideal way government should be. You should be out for the people, looking out for the people, and taking mm-hmm. care of your state, and making sure that your state government was in good hands, and that we all lived in each individual state, meaning that the state had control over, you know, most of everything, with the federal government having as little much control as possible, giving them as least amount of control. So I did get to meet him, and that's how I, you know, actually became a Republican, I would think, from that day forward. But, as I said, in 2005, it dawned upon me, and I guess it took me all those years of voting and just being disappointed all along, seeing people like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, and then, of course, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, John McCain. Now, listen, I knew about John McCain personally for a long time. Like I said, we were military brats living in Coronado. Matter of fact, I had his bracelet. They were POW bracelets that all the kids were wearing, and a lot of adults were too. And it was to show support for the POWs that were over there. And, of course, John McCain was in the Hanoi Hilton. And Admiral Stockdale, which was the commanding officer down there at the Hanoi Hilton for forever, was my next-door neighbor. He just lived a couple blocks down from me. So I knew Admiral Stockdale, but I couldn't get his wristband because it had already been taken. So I got John McCain's. And, of course, a lot of people know too much about John McCain, but he was like, yeah, he was always talking about being a maverick. Well, and that's put in terms lightly. Yeah, he really wasn't too much of a maverick. He's more or less like a loose cannon, more than anything else.
We'll get a chance to cover that more later. But I do see there are some folks already call in and like to have some comments or questions for you. our panelists. So moving on, as many with the questions, many are concentrated, of course, solely on the 2014 election, of course, coming up this year.
Right.
Why are you running in 2016? I mean, you're running now for the 2016 campaign. Why are you beginning the campaign during this election cycle?
Yeah, and then a lot of people also ask the question, why aren't you running for senator or congressman or something like that instead of going after the presidency? So kind of like chop that question in half, meaning the reason why I waited this time around was I live in a district where McClintock has it sewed up pretty much in the Republican Party. The conservatives already have their party and it's just sewn up here up in the county that I live in. So it'd be pointless for me to even try. It'd be a wasted, total futility. Not to mention that right now I feel that really there's only one way that we're going to be able to dig ourselves out of the morass that we're in right now, and that is that someone's going to have to get into power that has a little bit of power, constitutional power, to get some things nullified, overturned, some executive orders thrown out there to where we can actually make a change, as opposed to just maybe changing somebody else's mind. Matter of fact, in other words, I would not be effective in the least little bit of way being a representative or a senator or anything like that. And, of course, I guess my ego would tell you that why not be president? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm eligible. I'm qualified. Who says and where does it say in the Constitution that you've had to be a congressman before you become president or anything like that? And so I figured, well, heck, time to go.
Well, I know there's the adage where, a lot of your presidents came from being a governor. But, yeah, you make a very good point. And, I think it is important to start earlier. Romney was running for 5 years for president. And so I think it is important to get get the organization started early, because once the 2016 campaign, which, of course, will be starting probably immediately after the 2014 elections are over, it's very important, I think, to get the organization going. But moving on is now during the – to my understanding – in the 2012 election, you were not present, did not participate in the primary debates. Are you going to make some moves this time around in order to be a part of those?
Oh, yeah, that's not something that I did. Yeah, that wasn't in, believe me, it was out of my control. That's the point. Mainstream media and the powers to be, the parties, are the ones that determine whether or not you get in on debates at all. And let me tell you what, I would love to. I mean, I would give my eye teeth to be able to stand across from Hillary Clinton and just, say something like Vince Foster or Waco or Ruby Ridge or, Benghazi or, any of the number of things, or like her taking over the presidency the first week that she was, her husband won the presidency. I don't know if you remember or not. But she ended up calling a top level executive, members of the cabinet to a meeting to talk about what? National health care. Everybody mm-hmm. thinks Barack Obama's come up with this thing. No, this is one of Hillary Clinton's pet projects. Yeah, and she got body slammed immediately. The public, didn't really like the idea of her, usurping the power of the presidency. Of course, I wish they would have that, in their heads right now, because the guy that's in it right now really has no business being there at all. And then, believe me, I've got the goods on him for that. But that's neither here nor there right now. I'm sure we'll get around to it. And, that's the reason why I figured we get going really fast, get started, and, get the name out there, because really name recognition where it starts. In a grassroots, the millions aren't really needed that, say, like Hillary Clinton would need or you name the candidate, Cruz. Well, of course, Cruz can't run because he's not constitutionally eligible to run president. I've already written him numerous occasions and communicated with him, telling him that. Yeah. Well, the second he attempts to run, I already told him. I already have the attorney, and we got the paperwork half filled out already. So that's why he went to an attorney and got one. And then, of course, he denounced his Canadian citizenship. Well, I mean, that's ludicrous. I mean, if you think about it just for a second, let's say that Cruz had Russian citizenship and United States citizenship. You just suppose it. What, he gives up his Russian citizenship so he can run for president of the United States? Then he gets elected to be president of the United States, and what is he, right? A full-blown communist, you know, agitator or whatever, down with the United States, all that good stuff. So basically our founding fathers set that whole eligibility clause up to prevent divided loyalties. And that's one thing that, well, definitely you couldn't help it. There's just no way. Now, biologically, I'm French. Okay, you know, that's my heritage all way back when. We come from a little region called Domet in France, and we came with William the Conqueror to England and all that kind of good stuff. Well, the thing is that France could fall off into the ocean tomorrow, and I'd feel bad for the people, but I wouldn't lose any sleep over it, if you know what I mean. My loyalties belong to only one nation. Yeah,
right.
My loyalties
belong
to only one people, that's it.
And I want to bring it to the next question, because I think bringing up Ted Cruz is a good segue to it. And, of course, so far it appears that there are a number of folks positioning themselves, or at least have support for their run in 2016 on the Republican side for president. And you mentioned one of them, Ted Cruz, but there's also Rand Paul, of course.
Right.
And then Jeb Bush, was some are saying that, you know, he's the shoo-in. And, of course, Chris Christie. And there's a lot of support still out there, you know, for Newt Gingrich to make a run of it again.
Right.
So with that being said, what do you believe sets you apart from the rest of those to make you qualified to be president?
Can you break that just a little bit? Say that question more of the time, please.
What do you believe sets you apart from the other folks in the field, or the apparent field of presidential contenders for the Republican Party?
Well, this is just, I'm really sorry to be telling you this. I'm just, this phone's just breaking. Blog Talk is we got a problem. Is it down completely?
No, I still hear you.
I can hear you.
Yeah, you're coming in like that's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah,
so,
you know what, we've had
let's try it again. I can hear good now. Okay, go ahead. Try that one more time now.
Sure. And actually, I don't understand. We've had the technical difficulties last week. Remember that? We had Colonel Harry Riley on last week, and man, it just broke up really bad. And I even had a hard time hearing some of the guests. So I don't know what the issue with that is.
Well, I've got you now, perfect, so I can understand you. Fine,
okay,
no problem.
Great. No, you know, and mentioning those, you know, who are the apparent folks to be in the field, you know, at least, and of course I'll reiterate those names, Chris Christie, Jeb Bush,
right.
Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and Newt Gingrich are folks that are names that are put out there to be contenders for 2016. What do you believe sets you apart from them?
Well, I'll tell you what sets me apart. I'm exactly what the founding fathers envisioned when they created this country as the person that would lead this nation. Like I said, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And what we've got now, let's talk about the Bushes, just, you know, for an example. A father, a son, you know, and two sons are running. That's a monarchy. So if you take, you know, all the Bushes and the Clintons together, I mean, you're dealing with, you know, almost two generations of one family running the country. I mean, that's something that, you know, that our founding fathers never envisioned. And on top of that, the way they had thought that it would run would that, you know, serving one's country wasn't considered a job classification. And what it really was is that you were serving your country as a citizen. Get in, you get the job done. When the job is done, you go back to being whatever you happened to be before you took the office of the presidency of the United States. And that's the biggest difference between me. My whole idea is to restore the Constitution to its original form and intent. That's my whole idea. My whole idea is also to get back a separation of powers between the three branches of government, to get it back to where we don't have the judiciary legislating, and, you know, to be honest, even having the executive branch, you know, legislating, not the executive branch, the executive power, the presidency, creating laws, because essentially that's what Barack Obama has done. Now, in order for me to, you know, to reverse a lot of the things that have been done, should I manage to get elected, of course, I would have to get my best pair of Nike, you know, sneakers on. And, of course, inside the Oval Office, there's going to have to be, a, you know, something like almost 5 feet of papers probably getting ready for me to sign to appoint special independent investigators, you know, to go after every single human being that was really, that's been around ever since Barack Obama got elected, and to get down to the bottom and find out what exactly happened to the United States, because it's my contention that we were taken over in a bloodless coup, you know, when Barack Obama was elected. I mean, the guy hasn't, really, if you look at what he's done, everybody's got to realize that Barack Obama really isn't running the show. You can't play golf as much as that guy does and be president of the United States, right? I mean, how can you do it? I mean, I know that I would probably be stuck inside, not have my wife coming in at, you know, at 11:30, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, beat me over the head and say, you know, get to bed, honey, you know, one of those type things. Because I really don't see how the president can sit around and do what he does. Well, actually, you can if he isn't the person that's pulling the strings. And of course, we all know I'm not one of those people that you bought into all the conspiracy theories that are out there. But I do believe there's a lot of truth to, you know, actually what's happening, like with the world banking system and stuff like that, to where it's got the United States, you know, by, you know, where we don't want to be grabbed, and it's going to be kind of hard for us to get away from it. But actually, it'd be quite simple, especially with the power of the presidency.
That's an interesting illustration that you put on here tonight. And,
I get colorful. Let me know how black you want me to get, or how blue. I can get pretty blue, well, you know, for speaking. I'm a common American, and, you know, I don't put on any airs. The way I look at it, the person that runs as president of the United States is an employee of the people of the United States. You know, I'm an employee. My employer are we the people. And the point is, it's gotten around to where the president has become a potentate, and that he's a dictator, and that really it's shades of 1931 to 39 in this country again. And instead of, you know, the people running through the streets busting up Jewish businesses, it's going to be people running through the streets busting up Christian businesses. And I don't think I'm way off base by saying that. Matter of fact, I think I will probably be pretty prophetic about the whole situation if you really look to see what's happening in this country. And they're gravitating toward that right now.
I mean, in the audience, I would agree with you.
Well, yeah, I mean, sure. Right now, we already have, you know, a private military that the president has control over right now, giving way too much power to the United Nations. I mean, the thing that I want to do with the United Nations is get a, you know, a D-12 or, you know, a Caterpillar and just point me in the general direction of where the UN is, and I'll just scrape it right off into the river. Maybe give them a warning or not, I don't know, but there's never been a more worthless organization out there, because really all they are is against the United States anyway. They're just puppets for the rest of the nations of the
United
world
to
use against us. Yeah, and I'm tired of it. I am just, you know, sick to death tired of it. And I'm just like I'm your ordinary common citizen that I just don't come home and watch TV, dinner, and all that good stuff. I'm actually involved with trying to figure out how we're going to solve and how we're going to get ourselves out of the mess we're in. And I've got some very good ideas of how to get that done. And if people want to get that done, then what they'll do is they'll support me. If they want to keep doing what they're doing right now and just keep it to where our republic is headed over the abyss, right now we're hanging on by our toenails. And it's not going to take much of a, somebody can pass wind and knock us off. And it'd be that easy.
Wow. Moving on, I'm just kidding, with the passing of the wind, is that, and your president, you should
win. Gone with the wind.
let's
double entendre, take it the way you want.
That's okay. It's an organic show. In the president, you should be reading the Federalist Papers. Why do you feel that these documents are important, and why do you feel it's important for the electorate to know your views on them?
Well, yeah, here's the thing about this, and we fought that battle out between the federal government and how that was going to react or interact with the individual states. We did that, prior to the breakout of hostilities between England and the colonies, and of course, we did figure out that hey, we were going to be a constitutional republic, and that the federal government was actually going to be taking a back seat to the individual states. And of course, really Abraham Lincoln was the one that kind of put the kibosh on that and kind of ruined everything as far as the federal government, keeping to their 18 enumerated powers and the states having the powers that they were to have. I mean, that after all, each state has its own constitution for a reason. And a lot of people kids probably aren't taught as much in school anymore. I paid attention pretty much if I could. I mean, there's a lot of good-looking girls in my classroom, and I tried to pay attention to class as much as I could. And
that's
how
my
daughter
went to an all-girls school.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you keep her that way, But then again, you never know nowadays. But the thing is that I did pay attention. And we know that there's the 18 enumerated things that the federal government can do and what they can't do. And, of course, they've allowed the Commerce Clause to creep into everything that they do just for an excuse to go ahead and do whatever they want, with the states. But, as I understand it right now, I believe there's a little over a dozen states that have actually seceded from the Union already. A lot of people don't realize that. And, when you talk about, fast forward from the Revolution, let's go up to the Civil War, up in the 1860s, when we started having the problem, we decided that we were going to go have a Civil War over, and believe me, that was over states' rights versus federal rights. A lot of people want to say it's about slavery. Slavery was an issue,
right.
And I won't deny that one least little bit. But it was used, to flame or fan the flames of war more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is, slavery was ending. Actually, it was dying a slow death anyway. It was already outlawed, and it was going to be gone anyway. Believe it or not, about 5 blocks away from my house. My kid's his friend's father's last name is Whitney. If anybody knows anything about Whitney, that's the guy that invented the cotton gin. And the biggest job in raising cotton is really not so much as clearing the land and stuff like that. It was actually processing those seeds out of that cotton. And that was the real hard job. And when he finally figured out a way of doing that, that really ended the need for having those mass amount of people working on the plantations, but really, that's neither here nor there. We know that what the Civil War was fought over, and a lot of people they've deified Abraham Lincoln. I want to say it right now. I think Abraham Lincoln was a great man, but he did something like other powerful presidents decided that they got to do whatever they got to do to get things set straight up. He suspended habeas corpus. He did all kinds of, things against the Constitution that
mm-hmm.
you try doing it right now, people would go crazy, really, actually. And, that stupid John Wilkes Booth, had he not assassinated Abraham Lincoln, perhaps Reconstruction would have went along a lot better, a little bit better relationship with the federal government we have now, and the federal government would never have gotten the amount of power that it has right now. But, you know, everybody's got to remember, we're doomed to repeat history if we fail to recognize it, and boy, are we paying for it now.
Certainly. Let's bring this over to your platform, which includes issues such as immigration, education, public assistance, taxes,
uh-huh.
national energy sources, and a strong national defense. As the president, which of these do you believe is the most important and why?
I would say the most important thing that the presidency has to do right now is to get out of the state's business and let them take care of themselves as much as possible. The United States government was never set up to be a welfare agency. Neither was it set up to be the world's police force. You know, it just wasn't set up that way. And basically, I think that we have to do is we have to get back to allowing the states to get around to doing more for themselves and letting them take care of more of the business they need to get done, you know, in the individual states. Now, from the federal point of view, I say something that probably puts I know it already has. It's placed a big old crosshairs on the back of my head, and that's getting rid of the Federal Reserve and doing something about getting rid of the 16th Amendment of the Constitution, basically because that's not even supposed to be there. I mean, the Federal Reserve is totally unconstitutional, 100%. The only reason why we happened to do that is because we were bankrupted after the Revolutionary War, and we had to go to the banks over in England to do that. So by getting rid of them, a little anecdote, a lot of people don't know what happened. Everybody says, well, what's his name? Why am I sitting here going blank on the murder of John F. Kennedy? But the whole point is they ended up shooting him because 2 weeks prior to him getting shot, he signed in an executive order ending the Federal Reserve. So 2 weeks later, he's dead. And then, of course, that was rescinded. So Lee Harvey Oswald was, you know, the pastor for the whole situation. But that's not the reason why John F. Kennedy was killed. So I think probably the most important thing right now is to return power back to the states where it truly belongs and to restore the Constitution to where how it was meant to be ran. I mean, it's a document that was set in stone. A lot of people want to tell you that it's malleable, but it is
a living, breathing document.
Plastic. Well, you just can't just change the Constitution willy-nilly. The things that you've got to go through to change the Constitution is unbelievable, and the amount of votes that you have to get, it's almost impossible. So, I mean, just look at Prohibition, what they had to do to get that, you know, passed, or actually passed, and then of course rescinded eventually. I mean, what they ended up doing, they were the ones that the reason why the Untouchables recreated and the FBI and all these other organizations that take care of things like Al Capone and all those guys and Bonnie and Clyde, mm-hmm. You name the criminal, of course, you can place it directly upon Prohibition. So getting rid of the power of the federal government and returning it to the states is probably the top priority of something that I would do.
Okay, I'm going to bring this over to a specific economic issue, at least one that I'm seeing, with folks, is that during, of course, the State of the Union address, President spells out, you know, initiatives he or she would like to see implemented. And the economy has been difficult, of course, as you know, for many Americans and their families over the last 6 years. And there are, you know, those still who are unemployed, of course, or underemployed. And the economic downturn has made, you know, a heavy burden on the hardworking Americans. There's even a term that I haven't heard until recently, past couple of years, called the working poor. And so what they do is they see things such as their credit deteriorating from the increasing debt and inability to pay their bills. And currently, this is the crux of the issue, currently many employers, and you may already be aware of this, require credit checks for applicants to be considered for employment. Now, of course, I think that this hinders hardworking Americans from getting jobs or even better paying jobs because of it, especially with the economic times we're facing now. So as presidents, would you address this problem? And because I think this policy ought to be abolished. What do you think?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think that's really none of their business what your credit rating happens to be, whether or not you get a job or not. I really don't see any reason why you should have it. But, yes, I do. I am aware of that because I am among those statistics. I won't be ashamed to say it. You know, I make $117,000 a year. I live in California, and I live from check to check. I am not rich. Okay, I'm telling you right now that you know I don't go out to dinner or anything like that. Okay, I've got a nice home. It's not anything pretentious. It's just a nice little place up in the mountains. But living out here in California with the tax rate the way it is, and having to pay for the flood tide of humanity crossing the border every night. There's no way that I can really afford it. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I had an argument with an individual about the minimum wage. Well, let's talk about that for just a second. Getting this through people's heads is really hard, but it's a really simple concept to understand. And so what I'll do is I'll say, you make a buck, and a buck a day, okay, or a buck an hour, and I make $10 an hour, okay? And I've gone to better than 16 years of college. All right, I'm 16 years of school. Better than that. And not 16 years of college, but if I'd be a professional student. I'd be like the great Lebowski, always going to school, as a professional. Or what was the guy named Greenfield or whatever the guy's name was, where he always went to school, he's a professional. But anyway, I digress. But anyway, the whole point is that you're getting that buck an hour, and I'm getting 10 bucks an hour, and all of a sudden the federal government comes up and says, you're getting 10 bucks an hour. Okay, what do I get?
You don't get a raise.
Look, I don't get a raise. What happened to my earning power? It just went down. It just disintegrated. You, by doing nothing other than sitting there, being the benefactor of the recipient of a benefactor that is going to give you the money, so you'll buy your vote. He just increased your wages, but what he effectively did was he took mine away. So, really, the big problem here in the United States, and everybody knows what it is, and that's the outsourcing of American jobs. I mean, you could hear the suction sound, the vacuum of all the businesses that left the United States, because why would you hang around in the United States with the tax rates the way they are, with the employment costs and with the environmental laws that you have to abide by? I mean, would you stick around? I don't think so. I don't think anybody in their right mind would. I mean, after all, we do live in a capitalistic society, and I don't see anything wrong with being a capitalist society. I'm a capitalist. I like free and fair trade, but let's take China for example. Those folks over there, they can pay their laborers pennies. If they want to build an airfield, they can get out there and they've got enough manpower out there where they can pick up the pebbles and use shovels to make the airfield. Why we have to pay our people buku dollars to do whatever they want? Well, that's another thing Ronald Reagan instilled in my head when I was very young, and that was free and fair trade. And free and fair trade is that where everybody plays by the same rules, and whoever produces the best product at the cheapest usually gets the business. That's the way it usually works out. But that's not the way it's happened here in this country at all. And right now, we've got a tremendous trade deficit with China, and the way I look at it, not just with China, with other nations too. I don't want to just pick on China, but the whole point is, I mean, you can see what happened to our steel industry. I mean, it just disintegrated. It just went bye-bye, and of course that went over to that was just wiped out completely, and everything's being wiped out to where what we are is we're a nation of consumers, and really the only businesses you've got are service-oriented businesses, cutting grass, washing windows, you know, stuff like that. Or would you like fries with that burger, ma'am, or something like that. And right, and of course, our educational system is to the point where it's a joke, to where they're trying to force this Common Core stuff down on us, to where we don't even educate our children to the point to where they can compete with other nations' youth. So when they grow up, they're well prepared to do the work that they need to do, and our youth, they're not ready to do anything. And of course, I have five sons, and I'm, struggling to help all of them to get on their feet and get out, really, and they should all be gone. And I just heard a statistic the other day. They were saying something like, I don't know, 3 out of 5 people 35 years and under are living at home with their parents because they can't afford to live outside. And, I mean, that's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could remember when I got out, my father gave me for my 18th birthday, it was my happy boot day present. I actually got booted out of the house. That was my birthday present. Well, I hope you make it, son. Good luck. You're going to get hungry, but, let's hope you make it. I love you, but, see ya. Glad I'm not you. And so that's exactly what happened. Well, I mean, I can't do that to my children when our education system have indoctrinated, have dumbed them down to the point to where we can't do anything. If you try to do anything to get your children educated the way you feel that they should be educated, you're stomped down. And of course, that federal government sneaks its ugly head in there again and gets their grubby little bony fingers into raising our children. Like Hillary Clinton said, remember, it takes a community to raise your children, or a village. It takes a village to raise children.
Yeah, it takes a village to raise a child, yeah.
No. It takes a dad with a big belt and a mother that can say, hey, honey, guess what your son did today? I'm not talking about beating my kids to death, but you know what I'm talking about.
I felt the sting of the belt. We even called my dad's belt Stinger, if that tells you anything.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, in the interest of time, we'll move on because I do want to bring the panelists in.
Sure.
We'll start with Kelly, because he hasn't had a chance to come in, but I do have one last question I'll ask for bringing them in. And, of course, you're running in a political atmosphere within the Republican Party where the establishment, which, of course, are predominantly moderates, pretty much running the show and have most of the influence, even in elections, taking, Mitch McConnell from Kentucky and recently, I believe last night, to Mississippi, so Thad Cochran's victory over their conservative grassroots challengers, use it as an example. What do you take away from, these past primaries, seeing a lot of the establishment moderates winning their primaries? Now, we do have some successes, such as Brett, who won recently over Cantor, and we are working on getting Mr. Brett onto the show, and maybe as early as next Tuesday. We do have Peter Greenwald coming on next Tuesday, July 2nd. He was running in the primary, but then he stepped back so he could support and endorse Mr. Brett, and he, of course, came back and beat Cantor. So we're looking to have at least Peter Greenwald on the show, maybe Mr. Brett as well. But I'm in contact with him. We'll see how that pans out. But for the most part, we've seen the establishment moderates winning these primaries. What's your takeaway from that, and what do you believe needs to be done to get more conservative influence back into the Republican Party, including its leadership?
Well, here's the deal. I say, and I make no bones about it, I think the party system in this country is detrimental to this country. I think it's killing us. It's dragging us down. Like I said, they're sticking their finger up in the air and seeing which way the wind's blowing, and then they're going with whatever they want to go with. Not really interested in making sure that this nation survives as a republic. What they're interested in doing more than anything is maintaining that job that they've done their entire life and anything else besides that. and making sure that they, you know, that they keep their paycheck coming in and that they're going to have a nice retirement when they get the heck out of there. A lot of Americans and the people that I'm talking to, the people that I'm hearing, the people that I'm seeing, and I would dare say that I'm probably more in touch with the common person than I am with the elitist out there, and probably the elitist right now I would say would be those people that, that are running the show, the oligarchy that, that, that really really does run it. They act like they're enemies, but of course they're all the best of friends, so we all know that. There's no loyal opposition in politics anymore. I think it, if they're perceived as being moderates, I don't know. I think that that might be just a misconception. They may be calling themselves moderates, but I think the people that need to get out to vote aren't going. The people that could turn everything around, that are the majority, that are the silent majority, they don't want to see a moderate in there. They want to see somebody in there that's going to grab the bull by the horns, turn everything around, get the corruption out of there, you know, get the election process set up to where they know that their vote counts. I mean, the biggest thing I come across more than anything is saying, well, I'm not going to go out there and vote because my vote doesn't count for anything, and you know, the other guy's going to get elected anyway. So the people, they're not voting. So it seems like the moderates are getting elected because the moderate people are getting out there and voting. Now, you get somebody out there that speaks the truth, and the people understand that that person's going to get in there and whip, you know, the situation into shape, and that we're going to restore that Constitution the way it was meant to be implemented, you know, due to things like, you know, ridding ourselves of those people that come up with imaginary money and then lend it out to us and expect us to pay it back to them, stuff like that, and then getting all these people that were responsible for this this big debacle that we went through with the housing bubble burst and the mortgage industry getting all paid back, and all these people getting their trips to the Caribbean, drinking their margaritas while the rest of us are starving out. There's more people out there that want to see those people gone. They don't want to see those people in power. And I say that if the moderates are getting in power right now is because they don't have true conservatives or people with true constitutional values out there to vote for. So what they're doing is they're towing the party line, and they're going along with, and they think that they're getting something different, but they're not. It's just a different person, a different name. Same thing. They call themselves whatever they want. It's just a different name. It's just the same old sandwich, just a different bite. And you know, until we get to the point where we actually get to voting in people that are more interested in straightening out what's wrong with this country, nothing's going to change. Nothing. Nothing's going to change at all. So that's why my whole take on it is that the moderates are going to get in there because the only people that are voting are the people that have moderate viewpoints and that think that, you know, that by them going out and voting, you know, they're the ones that, you know, they're going to get the votes. But you get somebody out there like me that stirs up the hornet's nest and tells them, hey, look, we're going to see it. We're going to put the crunch on the people that have squeezed every drop of juice out of us, you know, our entire lives, and have made it to where we've had to struggle, to where we've got a class society, which we're not supposed to be. We're supposed to be classless. I mean, everybody's supposed to be equal in this Constitution, but we're not. We all know the truth. And until we get somebody that's out there that's going to say that, hey, look, we're going to do this, and I'm going to do everything in my power to, you know, flip it around, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get these moderates. You know, a moderate is somebody that takes the middle of the road position. We all know that, correct? So, you know, the point is, my dad always told me, okay, stand in the middle of the road, what happens? You get hit from both sides. And so the whole thing is that, you know, pick your side, stay true to your core values, and do, you know, tell the people what you're going to do, and then do it. And then get the heck out of town when you're done doing it, and then turn the, you know, the reins of power over to the next person. That will follow the Constitution, abide by it, you know, live up to its ideals, and execute it faithfully as they're supposed to, and then we'll be in fine shape.
And with that, I'm going to go ahead. I do see some folks in the audience would like to chime in as well, but first, we will have it in there. The first person will be from area code 660. I see you on the line and wanting to come in. And for those listening out there in the audience, there's still plenty of time here. And so join our roundtable discussion. And you can do so by calling us at 347-945-7428. That's 347-945-7428. And at this time, I do have Kelly on the line. Thank you very much, Kelly, for calling to the show. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing all right. I'm so inspired. I've got to tell you about my new business idea. It's just so stunning.
Go ahead.
Well, let's hear it.
All right. So earlier this month, George Bush Sr. had his 80-something birthday, and to celebrate, he did a parachuting jump.
Well, he does that all the time, doesn't he? Every birthday, right?
Yeah, and lately, yeah. So, yeah. You know, Fox News was totally, this was front news story, and you watch him land, everything else, he finally took off. All right, so I got so inspired. You know what's inspiring what he did? New business. It's called Parachuting for Politicians, where your first jump
shoot, huh?
is free.
Yeah.
No strings attached.
There
okay.
you go. Yeah, we knew that was coming.
Yeah,
I was way ahead of there, buddy. I thought you weren't going to pack the chute. Same difference.
Well, what I like hearing about you, sir, what I like hearing is you're an everyday person. That's what we need in every one of those positions of the 535 in Congress, and, of course, you've got the exec branch and everything else. And everyday folk, that's what we need. And in many ways, I'm glad you're running for president, even though if it, you know, can only make a difference. You know, Ron Paul made a huge difference for running for president because he got a lot of people connected, and his impact still being felt. So, you know, my hats off to you, sir.
No, thank you.
Yeah. So, Constitution, quick question. What are Article 9 and 10 of the Bill of Rights?
What are we going to do with them?
What is Article 9 and 10 of the Bill of Rights?
Article 9 and 10, and you got me. Let me think.
What are, Kelly? No. Go ahead.
Hold a sec. There is no, I don't think there's a 9 or 10, is there?
Well, I'm sorry, Bill of Rights, okay? The 9th and 10th Amendment, what are they?
Why am I going? I'm drawing a blank. I have no idea. I'm drawing a blank.
It's states'
right
rights.
Now.
It's absolutely states' rights.
The states' rights.
Nine basically says, hey, look, just because we've given you authority doesn't mean you're the end-all, be-all of everything. Number 10 said it a little differently. The rights not authorized to the federal government shall remain in the hands of the states and the people.
Well, I appreciate you pointing that out to me, and I drew an absolute complete blank in it because I'm sitting here thinking about everything else in the whole world. Yeah, as far as states' rights go, yeah, I'm definitely right dead on that, where the states, the actual power does belong within the states, and that as long as it doesn't supersede the power of the Constitution, that it belongs within the states and only within the states. But, of course, like I said, the Commerce Clause is the one that completely usually wipes that out, because they jump in on that and use the Commerce Clause to nullify, you know, the states' rights. And but, yeah, you're right. Absolutely, the power does belong with the states. I'm all for that 100%. That's where that's the platform they're running on. And, of course, you got me to where I completely went blank, and my hat's off to you.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm totally – we've done several states' rights segments, or I should say state sovereignty. States really don't have rights. They have power. The power that the people give them, because the people –
the people are the ones that have the rights, but the states are the ones that ensure that the power that the people exercise, you know, they actually get to exercise that power. And that's exactly why each state has its own constitution and how, you know, they set things up. Just like in Arizona, you can walk into any Denny's or whatever, as long as they have to say, hey, we don't want you to carry a weapon into it. But yeah, you're right. Absolutely, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. So I'm a big states sovereignty state sovereignty fan, if you will. Fanatic is really the long term word of the word fan, but it works.
All you manage to end up do is make it to where I'll have nightmares all night thinking about going dead blank on my most important thing that I think is probably the most important thing about the United States of America, is they call it the United States of America and not the states of the federal government. And I'll definitely be thinking about that later on this evening as I'm trying to doze off this evening, listening to your voice asking what the ninth and tenth is, and then going completely blank on it.
Dan, yeah, in fact...
That sounds really good, the guy doesn't even know what he's talking about when he's doing it, trust me, I understand what the state's rights and what they all entail, and the reason why they set it up to begin with, and why they argued about it, for 7 or 8 years before they even signed anything off onto the darn thing until everybody got, what they figured out each state was going to be doing, amongst themselves, and why, what started the Civil War and all that good stuff going on down the road.
The states became states in 1776. I was just reading something recently by John Jay. He was appointed as the Chief Justice of New York, the state of New York, in 1777.
As
the Chief Justice of the state of New York, Supreme Court, he was quite long-winded, but every word he picked precisely, and it's brilliant. There's the John Jay Society. I'm like, oh, my gosh. But, yeah, there's another evidence. Look, they were states. They had to prove it through a war, and then became states. Articles of Confederation and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Right.
And it's always amusing when you look at the history of this. The Constitution was passed, and then the states were screaming, hey, what about the Bill of Rights? Oh, whoops. Sorry about that, guys. We'll get that right out to you.
Yeah, really. Yeah, and, of course, the whole thing is they're trying to work everything out, what was going to go on between the states and the federal government, even before they got around too much of the Bill of Rights and what was going on with that. They are more interested in figuring out how they were going to get, each individual state was going to, how they were going to relate to the government. That's when we go back to the Federalist Papers, because they were trying to determine exactly how the state interacted with the federal government. Of course, most of the states are saying, well, really, your only job is to make sure that our commerce is taken care of and that you make sure that our borders are guarded and that, you do the things that we need to do to make sure that the states are able to remain free and let them decide what's important in their state as long as it doesn't go against what the Constitution says, because nothing trumps the Constitution. Even within the state's rights, but they do have the right to secede from the Union. And of course, I understand 12 of them have actually seceded from the Union right now. And of course, the federal government is going crazy.
Did they do this through a declaration that they are sovereign, or did they actually secede?
Actually, from my understanding, it's a secession. There's actually secession, and I believe Texas is one of them.
Missouri.
I'm pretty sure on that. This is a national secession and that's to where they wouldn't allow the federal government to come in and tell them what they were going to do with Barack Obama's, his health plan. How he was going to implement that. Nobody wanted to, abide by or adhere to that. So they said, okay, well, we're not going to implement this. You're not going to tell us to do it, and then we're going to go ahead. We're just secede from the Union. And it's not the same type of secession as happened during the Civil War, of course. But
Right. Basically
it was more that they weren't going to take anything from the federal government, even if it meant not taking freeway money or anything like that anymore, that they were done with them. But, go ahead.
Here's a kind of a stumper question, okay? True or false? Prior to the Constitution, were the states allowed to print their own money?
Whole problem was prior to the Constitution, everybody and their grandmother was printing money. That was the big problem. So everybody was printing. Yeah, everybody was printing money, and that was the whole big problem. And then after the Civil War, we were so bankrupt that we finally had to go around and borrow our money from from people that we really shouldn't have been borrowing money from.
Bankers,
and, of course, there was stuff that we needed to go through up all the way up, I guess, even all the way up to Franklin Roosevelt. We were still borrowing money that we shouldn't. And, of course, that Federal Reserve, everybody knows what they do is they conjure up money out of thin air. And then they lend it out to us, and then they expect us to pay it back. Well, on many occasions I've gotten a lot of arguments with people. I say, listen, this is what I'm going to do. Since they print imaginary money, what I'll do is I'll just grab my pen, and I'll pay you back with imaginary money. And we'll just end the debt right now just with the stroke of the pen. And they don't understand that that can happen, and it's very simple to do. You can do it by executive order. Now, what kind of trouble are you going to get into? Of course, you know, people are going to say, oh, you can't do that. You know, I can see China going through the wall and stuff like that. But I think really at the very end you would have the end word, the end word. I got to make sure I say that. But anyway, really, the bottom line is that the states would have the right to go. I mean, the president would have that right under executive order to just write the money right out of existence. We wouldn't know anything. Of course, you'd say that, well, that's not the right way to do it, but, you know, you get to thinking, you know, what are we going to do to get out of the mess that we're in right now? I mean, we've got an organization that has absolutely no oversight, has absolutely no control. The government really can't do anything about it, and we're at their mercy. So, I mean, how do we get it back? And the only way I could see that is you're going to have to get somebody that's going to fight that. Like I said earlier, I mean, John F. Kennedy, he actually did sign an executive order, you know, that was going to end the Federal Reserve. And then, you know, two weeks later, he's shot and he's dead. So,
well, there are two reasons why they shot him. Well, I mean, you don't do a coup d'etat that quick in 2 weeks.
Well, of course not.
He you know, the printing in the United States notes, you go to a coin collector, they'll show you a Kennedy dollar, which was amazing. It had no Federal Reserve note on it whatsoever. It was United States dollar. That was executive order number 11110. And before that, he was just saying, look, we're getting out of Vietnam. I don't care. We're not going into war.
The military-industrial
complex didn't like that. And if you look at the two, they work together. Printing endless money, military complex, military-industrial complex. Dwight D. Eisenhower warned us of this. Endless wars, and how many victories have we really had, like World War II? No. You know, it's one of these things where it's bad interest, evil interest. You know, what I would like to see is some everyday person like yourself that's raised kids who has got to get them off
and
started.
Yeah, have five sons, worry about their lives, yeah.
Yeah. Everyday people like you need to be in government. I mean, you're not doing as deep of a level with the Constitution I am, but I still... You've got the huge favor of everyday person. You're out here. You're suffering. You know what's going on. You're not an Ivy League school zipped into politics who is totally disassociated with the pain the American people are going through that they put us through, and that's something I like about you.
Well, also remember, you know, these Ivy League educated people and attorneys, I mean, that's what they're groomed for. They're groomed for how to get over on the people and how to get it done. And, of course, the Constitution is laid out in a way that it's a cookbook, and if you just follow that darn thing, you don't have any problem with, you know, running the government, if everybody abides by and follows it. But, of course, you know, then you have that separation of powers that you're going to have to strangle a lot of people and threaten to veto a lot of things. And, of course, then there's the hypocrisy that a president would have to do, and that would be they would have to actually sign some executive orders that might be questionable, because really, executive orders on them, on the face of it, aren't illegal. They're meant to run the White House, not to legislate laws, like they've been. Of course, you know, that's what they do right now. But there's going to have to be a point where you say, okay. Here's the argument I get a lot right now, because I tell people I've been after Barack Obama since day number one. I've seen Joe Arpaio, Corsi, you know, Jerome Corsi from the Swift Boats, you know, with Kerry and all those guys. A lot of the Congressman Barr, Klayman, just a lot of people. Just not to drop names, but just to let you know that I've met with and talked with a lot of people over what I managed to find out
and what I managed to do, what nobody else had the nerve to do, and that's to go after that guy. But in order to do the things to get even, or to get those executive orders that have really screwed this nation up, all these czars that he's created, all these different organizations, their little brown shirts or black shirts or whatever he happens to wear right now. I don't know what his little private army wears right now, but most likely it's the UN with the blue caps more than often than not right now. But in order to do that, you're going to have to sign some executive orders that are going to actually be laws. And I'm one of those people that do understand how the government works. I mean, it goes through Congress, then it goes to the president for veto or passing, and then a lot of people don't really understand, and here's the thing that really is a kicker, and people they really don't understand it. The Supreme Court doesn't have the time or the ability to look over every rule, every law that was ever passed and see if it was constitutional or not. And it just can't just affect one person. It has to affect quite a few people. And, I'll give you a case in point how that backfired on you. With Roe v. Wade, the gal was never raped. It was never a question of rape. But here we've got the Supreme Court that ended up coming up with a law that affects the rest of us, and they're not to do that. The Supreme Court's supposed to say this law is constitutional or this law is not constitutional. If it's not constitutional, it goes all the way back to the beginning. And then you go up through the whole system again, up to the president and then backward. And then finally, if there's no objection at the Supreme Court level, then that's what you're doing. But that's not what's been happening in this country for such a long time, that everybody's just gotten used to the whole idea that the Supreme Court's the one that makes the rules, and the president can too. But that's not the way it happens. So that's why we got to get somebody in there that understands that, you have a separation of powers, and that, you just need somebody in there that's going to make sure that you're going to get a veto if you try. Like Ronald Reagan had said one time that he had signed one bill that was something like almost 3 feet high, and they couldn't even read the darn thing, that there's no way any one human being could read it in 3 years, but they needed to sign it like within just a couple weeks in order to get the thing passed. I think a litmus test would be wonderful is if you were presented with a bill as president that if it had to do anything to do with anything else but the matter at hand. Now, I would go along with, attaching things that had to do with the exact bill, and it had something intrinsically to do with whatever that bill happened to be, whatever that law was, of letting it, ride on top of the bill. But if it says anything like, we got to milk 8 million cows a year and give the subsidies to the milk producers or whatever if you want to get this weapon system, well, then that would automatically get an automatic veto. One of those type things.
There's a much
he finishes, I want to bring Dan back in. Go ahead.
After me or him?
Me?
Him.
John? Well, I'm just saying, once I say, that's wrong. Just to finish up, I just said it would get an automatic veto if it happened to do anything. And essentially what that is the line item veto in a nutshell, and that's what, Ronald Reagan was after, and that's the big problem we got in this country is that our bills are so huge nowadays that, by the time you get around to passing a law, you've got so many attainers to the darn thing that you don't know what the heck you're going to do.
Right. Well, here's what I want to throw out to you, okay? And this is really huge. The reason why the Supreme Court is flooded with cases, because it was never designed to handle so many cases, because the states were to handle most of the issues themselves. Rare cases.
Yeah, rare.
Between states.
Yeah, that's what I said.
And that's why Congress was never intended to have such a workload and 3-foot-thick legislation or health care, let us pass it, then we'll figure it out. No, that was never the founders' intent. The states would have handled everything themselves.
Right.
And I just realized
right.
this.
I mean, that's exactly
like,
right.
Oh, my God.
That's why there was the 18 enumerated powers. If it didn't fall within those 18 specific powers, you left it with the states. You let the states deal with it. And a lot of people, turn to the gun issue. A lot of people do that. I I believe me, I'm one of those staunch people that say, what part of shall not be infringed don't you understand? You know, I get to saying, you know, things like, okay, the guy's a retard, you know, he's got, pardon my political incorrectness, mentally challenged, I guess, and that, you know, he's liable to go out and, you know, murder a million people, therefore he can't carry a bazooka. Well, the Constitution doesn't say you can't carry a bazooka, and it doesn't say you have to be, you know, have an IQ higher than 80. It doesn't say that. But being men of reasonable, you know, or being reasonable men, we don't want to see, you know, crazy people out there with bazookas running around, you know, the streets. But what they've done is they've taken that, and they've taken our goodwill, and they've completely and totally trashed it, and to the point to where us law-abiding citizens that would never think of hurt a fly, we have to fight to be able to protect ourselves.
Right.
And if I could tell you how many death threats I've had against myself right now, I'd be a millionaire right now, and I wouldn't even have to be talking to you. I'd be out there in the Caribbean somewhere. So, and, you know, I've got to find some way of defending myself.
Into your campaign.
Yeah. I mean, well, I mean, what I'm talking about doing is, you know, a lot of people don't like it. I mean, I hear, let's impeach Barack Obama. No, let's not do that. We do that, we've got to be the dumbest people that ever walked the face of the earth. First of all, he's not eligible to be president, so therefore he's not, you know, he doesn't have the ability to be impeached. He doesn't get that honor to be impeached. And on top of that, if he was to be impeached, of course, the Congress would drop the articles of impeachment, and then, of course, the Senate would have to try them, and then, of course, you would have to get the conviction. And then even the Constitution doesn't say that you have to apply a penalty. And the penalty is, the worst thing that could happen to a person, I guess, is that you can't hold office anymore. You get kicked out of office. Big rip. I mean, the things that Barack Obama has done right now is opens himself up as a candidate for treason. And, of course, we know there's all kinds of things that we can do to a person that's committed treason. So I argue about that all the time, and I get all kinds of people wanting to kill me over that. So that's all right.
Well,
I understand how that goes. I'm not afraid of it.
This time, gentlemen, I do want to bring Dan in. Looks like Kelly has dropped you. Hopefully he gets back in before the top of the hour. And speaking of that, before I get Dan in here, is for those of the folks listening to the show live, because we will be going into, as we usually do, into the extended period. And what that is at the stroke of midnight Eastern time, which is in 28 minutes, if you're listening to the show without calling in, then you'll be unceremoniously dropped from the call or from the show. But, of course, you will be able to listen to the rest of the show on the archive, as every show is archived, so you'll be able to listen to that. But, however, if you would like to listen to the extended version or be able to chime in as well, give us a call at 347-945-7428. Hopefully we can get Kelly back on before that other top of the hour, and I'll see what's going on with him. But while I'm doing that, Dan, you have the floor. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Robert. And welcome, John Dumais. You're very
well.
Happy.
Hello,
how
Dan. How are you? I got an uncle named Dan. Good name.
Well, sure. There's lots of good names out there, and names aren't
yeah.
really the issue. It's the message.
Right.
A couple of small points before I ask you a couple of questions. First
sure.
of all, you mentioned that you got a lot of death threats for your take on Obama's eligibility to be president and what might happen to him. And then
right.
you said you if you got a dollar for each one, you'd be a millionaire, you'd be in the Caribbean and wouldn't be talking to us. If you won the Powerball tomorrow, sir, if you won, or tonight, if you happen to be a multi-millionaire, are you going to give up on the fight to be president, or are you going to self-help
yourself? No, I was being facetious, and I was being flippant.
Thank you for that.
No,
please.
No, definitely. This is all near and dear to my heart. I could care less if I had a gazillion dollars. No, this is all about a fight of restoring the Constitution to its original form and intent. And right. and basically, yes, will I lie and say that I'm not after Barack Obama's eligibility? Yes, I am. That's entrenched in every cell in my body because, you know, I've been fighting it so hard and going after it. But, yeah, I thought about it when I said it, but, you know, I figured
you
most
want to be really careful with
the
language.
But, yeah, you're correct. You're correct. Absolutely.
Well,
I get yelled at all the time.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir. Only because you know that the other side is going to take a quote out of context, and they won't.
You bet.
They'll just quote it. They won't have you speaking in a sardonic or sarcastic manner. They won't say
sure.
what came before or what came after. Another
right.
small correction before I ask you. As I said, I've got a couple of questions here. You said the penalty for impeachment is simply removal permanently from office and the eligibility to ever run. Actually, there is one other thing that can happen once a person is impeached, whether it's a federal judge or a president or any other federal official. They are then liable. They're no longer protected from prosecution for ordinary crimes. So, and I think Obama
ordinary crime while they were in office, because
I
understood
exactly.
that they were exempt from, that they had immunity from any crime
they do
committed
until they're
while
impeached.
In office.
But, you know, I could be wrong. Perhaps Kelly, if he gets back
I
on,
could
we'll
be
able to
too. So I'm not going to say you're wrong, and I'm not going to say I'm right.
Yeah,
so
I'm not sure.
Because I understood that what it would do is that they're exempt, you know, that they would be exempt from being, you know, prosecuted, but that the removal from the office would be, you know, the extreme
penalty. Well, it removes
the
exemption. Yeah.
Well, think about Bill Clinton, for example. Okay, he was impeached. He directly, sat there and perjured himself. You know, what happened to him?
Well, he wasn't convicted, so he wasn't removed from office.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah,
privilege.
He wasn't convicted,
should have been prosecuted
right.
for perjury. You or I would have been, or anyone else I know. Small aside. My dad gave me 17. Papers said I was an emancipated minor, $100 and a bus ticket. But my kid is also living
at home. You got better than me, buddy.
Well, you know, I had to leave the state. You know, my kids living at home without a job because there aren't any jobs for them. It's really messed up out there. Listen, you mentioned Ronald Reagan, and
right.
to become a president, you need money. To
yes.
some extent, you need attention.
Right.
But more than any of these things, to get those things, you need that core message that Reagan so aptly communicated, and that even although it's completely disingenuous and lying, Barack Obama is able to communicate. Of course, he's not genuine
right.
about it. Had he
right.
done, or at least made a valiant effort to do any of the things he said in 2008, I think we would have had a decent president. Somebody we could respect, you know, let's close Guantanamo. Let's not get it into foreign adventurism. Let's reduce the deficit and reduce the debt and eliminate the deficit. Let's respect people's religious viewpoints. Let's, you know, be the most open and accountable administration in history. So looking at Ronald Reagan, and I want
right.
to preface this by saying that I've been listening to you, and you come across as a very real person, very personal.
Right.
And the conversational tone is very accessible. You don't come off as a typical politician, and I think this year, next year, and 2016 that's going to be a key. You don't sound like somebody who's lying to us. You sound like somebody we know, we work with, we're friends with, we're neighbors with, who's just having a conversation with us. And these things you're talking about are obviously heartfelt, and I have. Other than the few things I mentioned, found no errors in what you're saying. I agree with
right.
most of what you're saying here. But people need more than
right.
a list of grievances to fight against.
Absolutely.
They need a positive,
simple
message.
They want to hear what's
message.
Good for America and what the vision
Correct.
Of America is for after the damage is done and the offending person is gone.
Right. And so... Given that the people need a president who's also a counselor and a confessor and a teacher and an inspirer
right.
and someone who can speak to large groups of people who don't have the background most of our listeners have, they don't know the details and the history, which you've been very accurate with, okay?
Except for going to draw a complete blank on the 9th and 10th.
Yeah, well, you know what, that was...
Oh, no, I'm going to have nightmares over that one tonight, I'll guarantee you.
You know, that's going to resound in all 57 states, so...
or is it 59?
Exactly.
I can't remember.
But
yeah,
I get the message that you're saying. Yeah. I get the details and the history, but let's assume that you're speaking in a large public forum, either on television or live, to 10,000, a million, 10 million people. And
right.
most of them are unaware. They get that the bosses are all corrupt above a certain level. They get that
right.
we're all getting screwed. They get that the rules don't apply to them, but they apply to us. But they don't have the background, and I don't think a lot of them are necessarily interested, maybe not even capable of grasping all of the details of the history. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It doesn't mean they're dumb. Just means they have a different viewpoint, and they're not going to be policy wonks and political addicts like I am and like you seem to be. So what's your positive message to those unaware, uninitiated people? If you, Ronald Reagan said it's morning again in America. So if you could say
I'll give you the prime example. When Barack Obama gave his State of the Union speech, there was something that I heard or that I didn't hear that floored me. Usually when the president gets there, they say, "Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to report that the health of the nation is tremendous, is great." You know, he goes on to say how well things are going in America first. And then he to talk about the things that need to be improved upon, because regardless of what anybody says, I wouldn't live in any other nation on the face of the earth. And that I feel that even in the worst of times, living in this nation is better than living anywhere else. And even with the political system that we have now, the ability for me to get on the telephone and sit here and talk the way that I'm talking, you know, is something that needs to be talked about. But that's something that I noticed really, you know, it hit me like a ton of bricks that, you know, during the State of the Union address that a president didn't come up and say, even if it's bad, because everybody knows how bad it is. But if you'll go back and listen to just about every State of the Union address that I've ever listened to, ever, it's always been, you know, I'd like to report that the State of the Union is healthy and we're getting better. And I didn't hear that this time. It directly went into how bad things are and how we needed to do other things. And that's something that I want to relate to everybody out there that might be happening to listening to me right this moment, is that I do know that this nation is capable of becoming great again and taking its rightful place on the world stage once again. And I'm a historian, and of course, I really do, you know, Rome is my favorite period of history, and I can sit here and draw parallels all day long about how, you know, when Rome fell, I mean, we're doing the exact same thing that the Romans did just before, you know, in the 5th century A.D. I mean, and that's, we're doing the exact same thing. We don't need to be doing that as a people. We've got so much in this nation to, you know, to make things better. If we just get back to the document that's speaking up for us to, you know, to go by, that book called the Constitution, that thing that gives us the guideline to do the right thing and make sure that the people that do lead us understand that the people are the ones that are in power, and they're the ones that are the bosses, and we're there, you know, to represent them and to counsel them and to give them our opinion. And of course, you know, everybody can't, you know, everybody can't wear the feathers. You know, sometimes, you know, there's got to be a chief and there's got to be Indians, but the people have got to know that they've got a vested stake and interest in this country and for it to do as great as it can be. And I truly do believe that this country can once again take its rightful place on the world stage as far as being, you know, a national power. But I don't want that power. I don't want to be considered the world's Red Cross, and I don't want to be considered the world's police either. You know, there's a fine line in the United States what you really want this nation to be. Mainly you want to make sure that you provide for the citizens of this great country to do everything that they can do and achieve the dream that, you know, that we are all promised. promised by our founding fathers. And I think that that can happen. I really do. Not only think, I know it can happen. But, you know, and it wouldn't take, and it's going to take some time. I already know that. Don't think that for a second that I think that when you've got in 70-something years to mess everything up, because, you know, everything did work okay for a while there. And, you know, we've managed to screw it up over time, and it's going to take time to get it back. But somebody's got to take that step. My dad told me, you know, journey always starts with a single step. And understand that nothing's impossible, you know, as long as you at least try it. I mean, how many times, well, of course, you know, Edison figured out how many times before he got that light bulb to work, you know. So there's what, you know, we're going to run into all kinds of things, and we have to have a leader in there that's going to listen to other people that are smarter than he is, because definitely I'm not God's gift to creation as far as being Einstein and know everything better than everybody else does. But what I am is I'm a pretty good judge of character, and I'm also able to, you know, tell when somebody's blowing smoke up my hind end. And that, you know, what I try to do is I can tell when I'm being lied to. And I, you know, I definitely have a litmus test, and that litmus test is you know, you know, who comes first in this country? You know, who comes first? The people.
Got it.
People,
and you know what? That right there, the last thing you said might be the best slogan of all. You're going to have to boil things down. The American public, the world public, no longer sits around campfires and listens to stories. They no longer go to Lincoln Douglas debates and listen rapt as two great orators debate each other on fine points using every possible rhetorical trick and flourish over the course of 5 or 8 hours. They expect high production values, and you have to grab them immediately. What you just said, that is genius, to say, who comes first? And it's got to be boiled down to a slogan to grab them. Once you've grabbed them and they want to know, I'd like to know more, then you can fill in the blanks and the details. That's just a personal recommendation, just from a communication standpoint. Obviously,
well, actually,
as I said,
mean, you're absolutely,
I agree with
100% right.
Everything you
can
say.
Yeah. No, I appreciate what you said, because I understand that. I believe me, and I truly believe it in my heart. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this, because a lot of people think, you know, I'm crazier than an outhouse rat for even wanting to try to do something like this. You know, how dare you have the temerity to think that you can run for the president of the United States? And I says, well, I want you to tell me where does it show that I can't. And you know, and if you go back about 10 presidents, I want to know who really can really say that they're any better than I am. You know, education wise,
yeah,
whatever.
Way,
so.
Yes. Some of the phrases that you're using, you want to start featuring a little bit more, some of the folksy phrases, and don't be afraid of using some of the more modern idiom, but stuff like outhouse rat and blowing smoke up my hind end, I'm telling you what, that gets people laughing. And one thing Ronald Reagan also did, which was a positive feeling, he got them laughing with him, and then he got them laughing at the jerks who are the elites who are trying to run things. I tell people that if you sit there yelling at Barack Obama, you're going to accomplish a lot with people who are also angry, and the other people are going to go, oh, man, I'm not angry. That's a bummer. But if you get them laughing, I work today. You know, I have all these friends at work who are some are Democrats, some are Republican, et cetera, et cetera. And the IRS scandal was 100% easy to make them all laugh, because I gave them the top 10 list off of Steve Stockman's law that he proposed, the top 10 excuses that would be legally allowed to be used when the IRS audited you. It's genius, because they get it, and they can no longer, you can't defend against honest satire. You just can't defend against it.
No, you
so
really can't. I try to use that.
Stuff, that's awesome.
Well, just give you a little example of what I did. I got some people really laughing on it, and it's kind of vulgar a little bit, but I try to turn down the vulgarity whenever I can, because it's not very good. It's above me, and I really don't curse very often. I don't curse very much at all, except for when I slam a hand up against a hammer or something like that. And of course, I can cuss up a storm. But I saw a bumper sticker that said Hillary and Michelle. And when I saw that, I said, well, I said, it kind of, you know, it makes, you know, absolute, you know, perfect sense. And I got to make sure I say this exactly right, because I don't want it to go over too bad, because, well, anyway, it had a lot to do with the, well, people know what I feel about
it. I get the humor of it, and I have to say that Hillary, it's a shame for the people of the progressive ilk that she missed her chance, because really it should have been her instead of Curry, because we all know that Hillary really could have licked Bush.
And, well, and absolutely,
ooh,
she could have licked it really good. But I said Ebony and Ivory, and then, of course, I used the other, you know, the other, like you just did, Hillary and Michelle.
Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder are both incredibly progressive, out-of-touch people with a lot of talent, kind of like Alec Baldwin, who I won't spend any money on his films, but, you know, when they come on TV, and years ago when he was just getting started, the guy's an awesome actor. He plays a president, the hilt. He plays a CIA guy. He's funny as anything in that 30 Rock. Reading somebody else's lines, the guy's a genius. And I'm afraid that if he was a politician, we'd have another Obama who can really, really, really work that teleprompter. I am pleased the fact that you're able to converse on these issues in detail and hold your own, because you wouldn't be an Obama. Somebody asked you a question, I think you'd be able to come up with an answer that was substantive.
Well, actually, I don't use a teleprompter. They've actually had me try using or wanting to use one, and I just said I didn't want. I've been
what's
in speeches.
Like? I mean, I don't know what that's
I don't need a teleprompter. When you speak from your heart and you just say what you know, okay, like my dad said, you don't lie, okay? If you lie, then you're going to have to keep lying to keep out of the lie, okay? So that's one thing I, you know, got through my text call. Don't lie, kid. You'll be okay. Always tell the truth. And, of course, I'm not talking about white lies like, honey, you know, do I look fat? No, sweetie, you look as good as the day as I married you. One of those type things. But I don't lie to people, and I usually say normal things. Just right off the bat.
You know, it's true. I asked my wife just the other day,
Dan,
I said,
before we get to the top of the hour, I do want to give folks who are listening an opportunity to call in to listen to the extended version, and that is by calling 347-945-7428. And I do see some folks who are already in the call, and if you'd like to chime in, just push the 1 on your number dial, and I do see a couple of folks have called in. As I said, just push 1 on your number dial if you'd like to chime in. And I do want to bring in, before the live portion ends, Dan, we still have almost an hour even to the extended version for other things, but I do want to bring Michelle in, because I did tell her that I would bring her in shortly. So thank you very much, Michelle, for coming to the show. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing great. I actually have my daughter, Katia, and she would like to say something. Here she is.
Oh, certainly.
Hi. The topic that I wanted to bring up is college and how Obama's raised taxes for it. And, I'm in ninth grade, and, you know, I'll be going off to college in 4 years. And by that time, you know, taxes will be raised higher. And, I mean, today middle-class people can't even get into college without a scholarship.
You're right.
And Obama has made that where you can't pay for college, and scholarships are even harder to get. I mean, he's making it practically impossible for everybody who isn't rich to get into college.
And it is turning that way. And also, let me tell you, I just heard that Barack Obama just signed another executive order to where he supposedly, now I don't know this to be an absolute fact, and this is just from people that I've heard. I haven't looked up the exact executive order yet, because I haven't had a chance to. But what he ended up doing is saying that they're going to make the maximum amount of money you pay back on your college loans, if you happen to get a college loan, that it won't exceed more than 10% of your salary when you're paying it back. Now, that's a lot of money, 10%.
Yeah. Because
when you go to college,
it takes a long time to pay off your debts anyway. I mean,
Well, listen.
Your entire
let me tell
rest
you what.
Of your life.
Well, guess what? I took a college loan out. I'm still paying for it. Okay, so
yeah.
I can commiserate with you 100%. I understand how that goes. Now, the thing is, with the doctors now, education, the Republicans and the conservatives have been arguing it out for a very, very, very long time about how we're going to and how we're going to allow our parents or the parents to educate their children, how they're going to pay for that education, whether it be a public school or a private school. And, of course, a lot of the conservatives were saying that what they wanted to happen was is allow a voucher that they pay $3,000 to send a kid to school a year, just to go to regular grammar school, instead of giving it to the educators or that school. What they do is they give that to the parents and let the parents go ahead and throw in a, you know, pony up a few extra bucks, and then they can send the child to one of those, you know, high, those schools if you've got the mind. Or you can do what my dad did. And my dad said, son, you're going to community college. And even now, community college is unbelievable. When I went to community college, it actually tuition was free. All I had to do was pay, I think it was $10 or $15 for a student health card. But nowadays, I understand it's running just to go to a regular school. Like I graduated from San Diego State University and UCLA. And from what I understand, it's running like $6,000 a semester to go to that thing. I don't know how kids are going to. That's unbelievable, isn't it? Yeah, so now what are we going to do? So now here our children, they're not going to be able to be educated. They're going to be dumbed down even further. And
yeah,
then,
I mean,
you know, we've got to do something, right? We know
yeah,
we
the
all
employment
have
rate is already down lower. And yeah,
the unemployment
and,
rate,
you know,
yeah.
Without going to school, you can't get a good job.
But there you go. You're in a catch-22 situation. You know what that is?
I mean,
catch-22?
Huh?
Well, I'll recommend a book for you to read. It'd be a good one. You're in ninth grade, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, okay. Why don't you pick up a book called Catch-22 and read that book? Anyway, it's sort of do and darned if you don't. It's sort of like a situation to where you can't do right and you can't do wrong. So figure out a way of how you're going to get education, especially when nobody out there is really addressing, you know, how we're going to get our children educated. And, of course, we all know what's going to happen is, I don't know what kind of schools you've gone to so far. I don't know how, by ninth grade, you should figure out whether you are a liberal. You know what liberal is, right? Some of that, you know, it's for everybody. They want people to be happy, and they want good things for everybody. Of course, the nasty old conservative wants dirty air and all, you know, the lies that everybody tells you. We all want the same thing. We want children educated too.
My mom would like
the point
to
is, yeah. Well, what we've got to do is we've got to help our parents. The parents pay, you know, for the education, but the way you do that is that we've got a tax system in our society going on now where we're taking 60%. You know, in my case, my salary goes right to the federal government. I don't even see it. It's off the door. It's gone. So we definitely have to start figuring out ways of, you know, getting our children educated and getting a good education to where we can compete in the world, because right now the rest of the world is passing us up. I mean, China, Japan, those guys, their scores are just all through the roof. And it's hard to get that through. Now, my granddaughter's homeschooled. Okay, so my daughter-in-law is homeschooling her child because of the cost. And I mean that's one of the things. But right now, it's going to take somebody to get in there that's going to revamp the tax system to where your parents are going to have enough money to where they can save up for you so they can get you into school. Of course, I'm sure you want to get a job. Most kids do. I've got five sons, and I'll tell you what, they'd all love to have a job. A couple of them do. My oldest son is a military police officer. I got one that lays flooring, and then I have one that plays in the Xbox, and then I have one that watches what's the name of the guy? It's the drunken clam. They got a dog named Brian and something
family
like that.
Guy.
Family Guy. There you go. That's what my kid does, okay? And so, but they really want to work, but they can't get the job. No job because they can't get the education. They don't have the education. Can't get the education because they can't pay for it. And dear old dad makes enough money to where he can just barely keep his head above water. So we
I
all
have
to work
two
together.
In college and one in
yeah.
the Navy
ahead,
and one in the military, and I find that I'm having to help my kids out more, the ones that are in college.
Yep.
And my daughter that's in high school, she had a question about the college because I guess there's a few of her friends that are going off to college. But I have a daughter that's doing really well, and then my other son, he's not doing so well, and I'm finding I'm having to help him financially that he's in college. And then I have one in the Navy. It's just, you know.
You're doing the same as I'm doing.
Yeah.
You and I are
same
the same
thing.
Person. Yeah, we're in the same boat. Yeah, I mean,
not only
do I feel your pain, I know
help
your pain.
Them more often, more now.
Oh, yeah. Michelle?
Well, I call them boomerang kids. I keep throwing them out, and they keep coming back. And, you know, it's just something, you know, that I got to do. And I feel real bad because I want to make sure that I prepared my child, you know, the right way to where they're going to be able to succeed. And sometimes it's not the decisions that they make for themselves. I mean, our children are being indoctrinated. I don't know about your children, but I've pulled half whatever hair I've got left in my head. I know I do have quite a bit of hair, but I had more, but I pulled a lot of it out because, you know, the way that they were indoctrinating my children in the United States is one way when it really isn't. And, of course, the only way that we're going to get our kids into school is we're going to have to reform that tax system to where parents can afford to send their children to school. And to be honest with you right now, I started off this political campaign of mine quite early, and I have been thinking between a flat and a fair tax. And right now, well, first of all, I just to let you know right off the bat, I'm definitely against income taxes, okay, because I believe they're unconstitutional. Taxes are constitutional, but income taxes are unconstitutional. So there's got to be a way that we, you know, that we're going to have to get around to taxing because we have to provide people. You know, look, teachers aren't going to teach your kids for free. We got to figure out some way of paying them. But they can't put us out where we can't send our children to school. And I'm not going to be one of those people that said, hey, you know what causes it. How come you have so many kids? Because I've got five sons, okay? So I guess both know what caused that, right? So the point is, you know, I don't know how many boys and girls you got. The difference, like, well, you got three boys and two girls. Is that what it is?
Oh no, I have quite a few. I have six daughters and five boys, and I have two in college and two
Woo-hoo!
In the military, and one going into the military when he graduates high school next year.
What? I had an ex-girlfriend that
you
had 12
kids
in their family.
I have 11.
13.
Yes.
11.
Wow.
And they all turned out to be really fine kids. I've never had no problems. At one point, I thought about homeschooling, though, because some of the issues I don't agree with in the school system, like this, you know, I think that they're just passing our kids.
Absolutely.
Some teachers are really good and some schools are really good, but then I find that, you know, there are those schools that just pass your kids. You know, anyway, you know, you sit there and
it's
you'll
It's called
have
social
to,
passing. Now, let me tell you this.
And
I can
I
tell
don't
you
like
right
that.
Now.
It's not teaching our kids nothing.
I can tell you.
One person at a time, please. Sorry.
Well, I can.
Go ahead, Mitch.
Well, what I wanted to do, the reason why I want to break in is
John
before I forgot it. The reason why, Michelle, the reason why I wanted to break in because I want to tell you that I know what I can tell you the answer is going to be. It's because you have so many kids in the school system, and I have too. Now, what you
half
do
of them
is
grown up now.
Right. Well, mine are all, but my youngest right now is 21. But anyway, when he was going to high school, okay, we built a brand new high school up here where we live. I live up in the mountains. Brand spanking new high school. And you would think the kids would be just tickled pink to go to a new high school because they get to pick the mascots and all that good stuff, all the school traditions and all that kind of stuff. But the teacher that we had at that one school at after 3 years, almost the fourth year, she had to brag how she had a zero dropout rate at her school. And the reason why she had a zero dropout rate is because if there was any kid that had any problem, she shipped them off to a continuation high school. So therefore, that's the kind of school systems that we've got going on right now, and that's the type of people that are educating our children. And, you know, that has to be addressed. And that's getting parents more involved in with what's going on with the kids and giving the parents more power to decide what's going on with their kids instead of the federal government. And really even at some point, even the state government's telling you exactly how the children are going to be educated. And that's something we all have to get together, you know, as a group, you know, and work together on that. And that definitely, our children, if they are left in the dirt, our nation is doomed. That's all there is to it. Our children come first, and let's take care of that. And I'm willing to work on it. But I think you're going to need just about another month or two before I absolutely decide whether I'm going with the flat or fair tax.
Well, our children are our future, and I am impressed with the school they're going to now. They have morals and values, and I'm talking about my sister is sending her kids to a public school, and they seem to just pass them without really teaching them. Like, they're not as educated to me as my children. And I think parents need to be more involved with their kids, definitely. You know,
well,
like involved in every aspect of their life. But my daughter was wanting to talk about college, even though she's only in the ninth grade. And she said, Mom, can I ask him a question? I guess she was concerned because the tax is going up. And no matter what, my kids are going to go to college. I have decided to join the military instead of college. But I've had pretty good kids. God's blessed me. And I have thought about homeschooling, but so far so good with the school they're in. I'm very impressed. It's they just started the school 2 years ago. And we've had good communications with the teacher. It seems like they're moving ahead like they're supposed to, and just very impressed.
Yeah, it's going to be harder for your daughter. I mean, I hate to say it to her, you know, and I don't want to discourage her, but she sounds like a young lady that's got her mind made up that she's going to go to school. And of course, you know, she may have to go to a community college for a couple of years to cut the price down on that. And then get some help from mom, you know, with the housing. And you know, she might not be able to go to some Ivy League school. One of these, I don't know exactly where you live, but out here I'm on the West Coast. So, you know, we've got some pretty expensive
schools. I'm in the Midwest.
Here, but, yeah. Well, I'm from Illinois, so we got a few out there too. But the point is that, you know, the kids have to drag, they really have to pull a lot more weight than they used to have to. But there's a lot of things that we have to do here in America to get things straightened up to where we're banging on all eight cylinders again, where we've got our businesses back here instead of being shipped overseas, and we stop getting involved in every foreign entanglement that happens down the road. I mean, that's right if you think about it just momentarily. I mean, really, if we would have left Saddam Hussein and Iraq, I don't think we'd be having the problems we're having right now. I mean, right now, Barack Obama wants to send 500 ISIS to Iraq, what, be shot and killed? I mean, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, with 500 troops, I don't even know what the point is.
They're cannon fodder, that's what they are. It reminds me, you've got 11 kids, so you know what the Bay of Tonkin was. And so understand what happened with all that. And it's just shades of Vietnam all over again. I mean, that's what I can see.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I interject just a moment on this topic? This is Dan Gray.
Real quick, Dan, before you do, real quick, go ahead. Here's how we're going to do it, because I do have another caller who would like to chime in, and we want to bring Tessa in shortly, because I just spoke through on the line.
Good.
We'll go ahead, Dan, and then I've got one quick question for Michelle, and then we'll bring Tessa in. So go ahead, Dan.
Sounds good. We're talking about the future. We're talking about our posterity. We're talking about children, and we're talking about prosperity. As a president, in addition to a bully pulpit, in addition to the power of the veto, in addition to being able to propose legislation that could be entered in the House or the Senate, depending on whether it's a funding bill, and then passed and come back to your desk, you have the power of the administration. And
yep.
In past administrations, that power has been to grow and to write regulations. However, when a law is passed giving you the power to write regulations, it doesn't require you to write regulations. Not only that, you can rescind regulations without actually changing the law as long as whatever you do remains within the purview of the law. For instance, the EPA under the Clean Air Act, which is on the face of it not a terrible idea that we want clean air, has decided to regulate just about everything. And they've decided just on regulation under the Navigable Waterways Act to say, well, you know what, if it's a puddle, if it runs wet any time of the year, it's navigable, and we have jurisdiction, and we can tell you what to do with it. The key to prosperity is liberty. Government didn't create the wealth. The wealth was created by all the people working individually and together in voluntary associations for their own self-interest and the interests of their community on things they wanted to do without the government interfering. I've run businesses for other people in the past, and I've run my own business in the past more than one time. And the thing is, I couldn't do it today unless I had $1 million to start with, because I'd have to hire a lawyer. I'd have to hire an accountant. I'd have to hire a compliance officer. Depending on the type of business, I might have to hire specialized compliance officers for the regulations that might deal with environmental or other issues.
Right.
And this is impossible climate for anybody who's an entrepreneur. As a matter of fact, ma'am, your children didn't get the benefit that I had as a child, that my daughter had, because we live in a region that's pretty traditional. Your children today cannot open up a lemonade stand without some bureaucrat from the federal, state, or local government clamping down on them saying, you can't do that. I had a power mower when I was 10 years old. And I made money, and you can't give a child a power mower, and you can't have that child without vetting and bonding and insurance and OSHA regulations. Simply maintaining a piece of power equipment and mowing people's lawns, and I had a bank account, all right? So that's the only point I wanted to make, which is that as the President of the United States, there is something you could do immediately, which is to start slashing, burning, and cutting any regulation that isn't required for basic safety, protection against fraud, and national security. The rest of it can go.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know if you've ever had the chance to get on the campaign site, but, I mean, it's putting down in black and white. Absolutely anything that has anything to do with, you know, czars or anything that really doesn't have anything to do with the running of the federal government, and I'm talking specifically the running of the federal government as opposed to what's going on with the state and the individual, it has to go. I mean, it just has to.
Before we bring on the next caller, I want my incandescent light bulbs back, damn it.
Yeah, well, who said, well, and why not? I mean, you know, seriously, I mean, I don't see really big savings with those fluorescents, and I can't see a darn thing with them. And I think that they ruin my vision because I try to type to people, you know, when I'm sitting there on the darn iPad or whatever, and I'm always misspelling the words, and, you know, it doesn't, you know, help that I've got dyslexia. But anyway, the point is that my fat fingers and bad vision from using those fluorescent bulbs, I want those back, too. You know,
well, the old ones, you might, if you break an old one, you might cut your foot. The new ones, you might cut your foot and get mercury poisoning.
Or whatever they put that fluorescent stuff, you know, get dust.
They do have bulbs that don't have mercury in them, right? But they do have those, because I've got a couple of those that don't have the mercury in it.
It's Robert Joe.
I
want
to bring it over, real quick question.
There you go, Robert.
Michelle, and then I'll open up the line to Tessa. Is Michelle, does your daughter know what she wants to take in college?
Yeah, she wants to take international. She wants to be an ambassador one day.
That sounds very ambitious.
Yeah, she's...
Well, if she ever is an ambassador to Ireland, you know, I'll volunteer to be on her staff. Well, I can't volunteer, but...
Well,
you know.
I always encourage their big dreams. And, well, my mom's cousin is a representative, House representative in Missouri. And so I come from a background of military, and they're all into political politics, and I come from a Republican family. And my kids are always asking questions, and even at a young age, they're smart. They already know what they want to be. It's just like my son that just joined the Navy. He was talking about it all through high school, and he did exactly what he said. He wants to make a career out of it.
Yeah, my kids are very determined.
But she's into international studies.
Odd, but I don't know. My daughter, she's 12, and she talks about, she's been talking about for a couple of years wanting to be a nurse. I'm just kind of like, I don't know where she gets that, because, I mean, nobody in my family except my brother's wife is in the medical field. But I don't know, she likes to help trying to take care of people. But I do want to bring Tessa in. So thank you very much, Tessa, for calling to the show. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, it's good. It's great to have you on.
Hey, it feels good to be breathing. How's it going, Tessa?
It's going great. And Dan hit upon something that I was going to talk about. A couple of my children are not really all that interested in going to college. They would like to start their own business, but with the,
sure.
with the business, yeah. But with it being so difficult right now for anyone to start a business, and I'm thinking that your message is very good, but perhaps if you could tap into some of the populism that is going on out there.
Yeah, how are you
going
to get the money together to send your kid to a trade school? Because that's what my dad set me off as a trade school. I had two children that didn't want to go to college, too, and they wanted to do the trade as well, and I encouraged them 100% on that.
Oh, yes, of course. And, we realize we're going to have to take out loans, and we understand all that. But it's not just from that standpoint. It's the simple fact that they would, they want to get into computers, but there's so many laws and regulations now with disposal of parts and, different things like that, which would be prohibitive. And then there's the one of them wants to be a plumber, which, he may not run into as many difficulties, but you just really have all these regulations and all of these rules and all of these laws and all of the taxes. But from the standpoint of your message, whenever you're out there talking, one of the things that perhaps you could talk about is the difficulty of starting a business, and if you really wanted to do so, especially at a young age, instead of going to college or going to, but consider for a moment you've got Bush, Obama, et cetera, that always have all of these people around them.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly to help make these regulations and help with the tax code. But who are these people? These people are the Jeffrey of Malta in this world. What you want to do is see if you can, I would do talking about getting in the small business people. Bring them up. Talk to them. Don't talk to the Jeffrey of Malta, right there, coach. Talk to the people, if you're talking to the populace, if you're in front of a group at a town hall, say, the people that I'm going to consult will be you. I want to know what is causing you problems. I don't care what's causing Jeffrey and Malt problems. He's not anybody I'm concerned about. I want to know about you. Whenever you're talking to people.
Yeah, because it's about Trump. I understand that, yeah. And I do that, to be honest. But I do that all the time. Yeah, I've done a lot of speeches, and I do turn to people and ask them. I've done a lot of town hall speeches, and I've asked people, what's their impediment, to getting going in their own businesses and things like that. And most of it is dealing with all the businesses that are being sucked over into different countries, everything from manufacturing everywhere. Right now, we're in a service-oriented economy. Most of everybody
wonders,
do you want, like I said, do you want some fries with that double cheeseburger? And that's mostly what most of the jobs that kids can get nowadays out here. And now they're talking about making a minimum wage job. I mean, raising that minimum wage. And the reason why they're doing that is because there's no other jobs out there for the people. So they've got to raise these wages. And that's the reason why the minimum wage is being raised, because we don't have the jobs that we used to have here because we ran them out of town. And now what we got to do is we've got to get those guys back, and I talk about it all the time, about how we're going to get those people back.
Yes, exactly. And I think that the conservative message is actually the best message, but I do believe that we do not cloak it in the proper terms. We tend to get a little bit into the weeds on a lot of things instead of talking to people in ways that they can understand. you know, you start talking about the Federal Reserve, you start talking about money of that nature, and they tend to zone out because they don't really understand it. So, you know, one of the things that, that I think the candidates really need to work on is how to talk to people in such a way that they're not scared, that they automatically think they're not going to understand it. You tell somebody, do you know that we have the power to print money, but we don't do it? We borrow money from a bank, so, and then we immediately start out in debt. You know, you start talking to people like that, they're like, what? Yeah, I do it all the time. I always talk, you know, you tell them, hey, you know, our government borrows $1 billion. They automatically have to pay back X amount whenever they actually have the power to print money themselves for free. Why are we borrowing money when we don't have to? And people are
we're borrowing it from the government, ma'am. We're borrowing the money from the Federal Reserve, which is a private corporation.
Well, yeah, I know that, but I'm saying that a lot of people don't understand that. They don't understand that whenever we get this money from the Federal Reserve, we're automatically in the hole. You know, they don't understand
it's imaginary
that
money. That's what it is. I try to explain it to them. I just say, look, it's imaginary money that they're printing, and they're expecting us to pay it back. The Constitution specifically states, and I mean, you can, I guess you can tell it to the cows come home to a lot of people, but the Constitution does say that the federal government is has the power to coin money and that it has to be based upon something of intrinsic value. So if you try to tell them, okay, that's got to be gold, silver, diamonds, or whatever like that, and then you've got to help them make understand that it's the federal government that is supposed to have the control of printing the money, and therefore the federal debt that we owe the Federal Reserve, which oversight or anything like that, those folks really, I mean, they pull it out of thin air. And I understand what you're talking about. People zone out when you say that, because you say, all they do is they say, okay, we're going to print up $3 trillion. And then they're going to spread that out all over the United States and the different Federal Reserve branches all over the United States. And then, of course, we're going to have to pay them back, you know, with the money that we are in and all that kind of stuff. But what they did is they just pulled it right out of thin air. I laughed at that one. I think that's the hilarious thing in the world, because it's based on nothing.
Based on nothing, but even the very idea that a lot of people aren't able to understand, that one thing they can understand is, you know, we can make our own $1 trillion ourselves. We've got the legal right to do that. But instead, we're borrowing $1 trillion so that we can pay them back $1,500,000,000. And why are we doing that when we don't have to? Now, that's something that they can understand, because they're like, well, that's just stupid. If we can do it ourselves, why are we borrowing money from somebody else? And I said, that's the point. That's exactly what I want, you know, this is why we don't need the Federal Reserve. Yeah, because it is something. Yeah, because they can understand that. They can understand that they have $100 in their pocket, you know, if they have, and they can use it, or they can go borrow $100 off of somebody else to pay back $120. Why in the world would they do that? And that makes no sense.
Yep.
So they do understand that portion. The fiat money and all that, that's a lot more complicated for most people, especially when you've got the Keynesians out there going, well, it's backed by the full faith and whatever of the government. And they're going, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. You know, to them that kind of sort of makes sense. So,
folks like you on these things, because I keep telling people occasionally that, and I pride myself upon it, I'm not a professional politician. I don't want to be a professional politician, but I want to be able to communicate to people that help them understand how their government works, so they know whether or not they're being had or not. Now, you've got to know whether that, you know, the guy behind the curtain that's pulling the strings isn't saying, I'm the great and all-powerful Oz, you know, and I'm pulling that curtain open, you know, and see what they're doing, and I don't want people to think that I am that special politician, and quite frankly, you know, I get carried away, and I start educating people and trying to do things like that, and I've got a campaign manager that, I mean, he pulls his nose hair out. He just forget about his hair. This guy goes for his nose hairs. He gets so mad at me because he says, stop educating the people, John. They don't want to hear an education. They just want to hear the facts. And I say, I got to, you know, kind of give the people a little bit of background so they understand what's happening to them. But I'm getting further away from that. And
And, yeah, I appreciate the advice. I really do. It's not something I'm going to say, well, you're another know-it-all. No, I appreciate it. Trust me. Anybody that can help me, be a better communicator to, get these ideas across to people said, more the better.
Well, I was just really, I think in a way, I was sort of reflecting some of the things that Dan was also saying, we like politics. I read about politics all day long. I talk to people who like politics all day long on all sides of the aisle. So for somebody to talk to me about fiat money, that's not really anything that's going to cause me to even blink. But 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I would have just walked off. I'd have been like, I don't even, you're crazy. It's backed by something. I don't know what it is, but you're crazy, and I would have walked off.
Yeah.
Now
yep,
that I'm looking into it, exactly, and that's probably a good 80%, well, maybe 60% of the population, but, so that's, I'm kind of echoing what Dan was saying. The message has got to be such a way that people can understand it quickly. It's got to be simple. It's got to be something that will stick with them.
Right.
99%.
Every time I talk to good people, I get that just that much better.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to hand you over to Dan and Robert. Thank you for talking to me. I appreciate
thanks.
It.
Thanks. Well, thank you for calling.
Well,
I really
appreciate
it.
Thank you very much. And, of course, as with all the folks who call on the line here at Bard's Logic, we will keep your line open, so if we can bring it back to you, we'll do that. Or if you'd like to chime in, just let us know. But we'll go ahead and bring Dan back on. Thank you very much, Dan. The mic is yours.
I'd like to bring a new topic into this. Mr. Dumais, you're running for President of the United States, and you're running in a civil campaign that would be a peaceful transition of power, as thank God we've always had in this country. And there are those who quite realistically point out the significant dangers that we've reached a tipping point where if we go much further down this road of progress, we may end up with a true dictatorship. And I have said this publicly, and people don't think I'm a nut job, I hope. My family was wiped out in Europe by the Holocaust. It's not because, and you said earlier, it might not be Jews, it might be Christians this time. Whoever they come for, they end up coming for everybody who sits in there, has something they want, or just to make a point. And the federal government has that much power and that little accountability. I've never seen any government that got much further than we are right now, that where it ever turned out well. So right now, as we speak, I'm multitasking, and here in Pennsylvania, we have militias who are all, so far, incredibly peaceful people who break no laws, who are willing to assist in cleaning up parks and helping find lost children and doing civic work and helping in disasters. But they're also preparing quite seriously, men and women of all ages, many with military backgrounds, some without, for the possibility that on to reinstate the, or at least fight for rule of law, of constitutional law in this country. And now, in the Pennsylvania militia, to my shame, because I know both these guys and they're decent folks, there is a small riff, like a high school fight. And these people, who I have a great deal of respect for, have decided some legitimate reasons that they get along with each other, and they're airing publicly, and I'm taking them both to the woodshed while we're doing all this. I'm messaging them. I'm going to meet with them personally. And not the first time. So I'd like you to address two things. What is the realistic possibility, in your view, that U.S. forces may be called upon to act against U.S. citizens against
right.
the Constitution? And secondly, the unity aspect, and this is perhaps the most important thing. Whether we are behind you as a presidential candidate or someone else as a congressional candidate or a governor candidate or a Senate candidate or around an issue, the unity of viewpoint, of a simple, very, very clear intent to restore limits on government that bring us back to the Constitution and let states make their decisions and let individuals make their decisions. And as long as no harm is being done to anyone, then it's not the government's business. But this unity thing, I keep running into this in every single movement, in the pro-life movement, in the Common Core movement, anti-Common Core,
yes,
in the militias. Yes. Everywhere you turn, somebody's got a personality issue or a process,
yep,
issue, or they think they have the right answer and the other person doesn't, or they hurt each other's feelings. And I honestly don't think we have the luxury of hurt feelings. Our opposition, the so-called progressives, who are very few, and they run the Democrat Party and a good chunk of the Republican Party, but they don't represent the people of either party, the 99% of the people out there who just vote, but if they vote, but don't really adhere to those views. These people have one thing way over us. I mean, besides the fact that they can lie with impunity, we don't lie at all if we can help it.
Right.
What they
have, we feel bad about it when we do it. Yeah.
And admit it and fess up.
Yep.
But what they have is discipline. And I am really getting tired of this, and I'm wondering, if you're a president, you're going to have to be a leader. You're going to have to be the one who steps in sometimes and pours oil on the waters and invites them all and offers them all something nice and has a beer summit. You're also going to have to be the guy who calls them all to task and starts yelling at them and pounding a shoe on the desk as, you know, Khrushchev did or whatever you got to do.
Right, right.
To cow them into place, because right now the things that I'm seeing are so typical, they keep happening, and they are completely unhelpful at all. We've got one group that wants to do things one way, which is legitimate, and another group which wants to do things a different way, which is legitimate, and because they can't agree, the leaders are having a fight, and now all these other people are going to suffer because of it. So I've spoken enough. Please address those issues, if you would.
Now, simple as this, and I know exactly what you're talking about because I deal with it every day myself, called divide and conquer. Exactly what's happening to us. We're being divided and we're being conquered. I can tell you right now, and here's the deal. You were talking about the militias and some people talking about, hey, maybe we're not going to be able to elect somebody, that we're going to actually have to get down to cutting bait and actually, you know, and down to the point, and maybe we're going to have to do what, you know, some of the founding fathers said every once in a while. There has to be a time where we have to have a revolution in order to cleanse, the bloodstream of freedom or whatever. I've heard that a million times, and I'm always fighting against it because I keep telling the people, listen, you can't even get together and get behind an individual that says what they're trying to do is use the Constitution to fix what's wrong with this country by doing it legally, by doing what our founding fathers had fought so hard and so many people had died, you know, throughout, the history of this country to ensure that we have, our franchise, the ability to vote, and, our liberties, our freedoms, and all these other things. But they're all sitting out there telling us how they're going to get and they're gonna start a war with the United States military, and that's what we're gonna have to do. And then I tell them, I say, okay, here we go. What's easier? Getting behind somebody like me. Not me, somebody like me. Okay. Put all the support behind that, do them whatever you can, vote for that person, and if you have to, if you're worried about voter fraud and all that kind of stuff, go ahead, use a paper ballot, mark it with a crayon and whatever color crayon you use, dip your hand in whatever color paint that was to show that you voted. So at least you voted and the votes are being counted and all that kind of stuff. I've heard all the arguments. But then again, I tell people, I say, listen, here's what you want to do. You don't want to try that first. What you're talking about doing is running out into the woods. Okay, and we all know what we're capable of doing. We've watched what happened in Iraq over the last couple wars that we've had there. And one day you're going to sit there and you're going to be hiding in a hovel somewhere, and you're going to have to use someone, and you're going to walk off to a rock, and you're going to really have to, you ate something really horrible, and
has to hide behind a rock. And unbeknownst, when you get out there to the rock, you look around and there's nothing around but poison oak and a couple pine cones. And what are you going to use to wipe your hind end with? Well, I mean, it's very simple. All you have to do is just raise up just a little bit and just hold there for about 3 seconds, and you'll see USAS go right underneath and go ahead and, you know, take care of business for you. There is no way that you're going to beat the United States.
Are you there?
Side. You're not going to do it. And the whole point is that if we're going to do this, we're going to have to do it within the bounds of the law, within the constrictions of the United States Constitution, and we have to do it united, as a united front, and stop this bickering, this high school bickering, like you call it. I see it every day. Every day I see it with people, and within my own campaign. I started off in 2005, okay, 2008, I dabbled with it. That's when I got the standing to go after Barack Obama. At 2012, that's when I said, okay, well, why couldn't I be the president? And then I started noticing that people who were joining my campaign were starting to bicker among themselves. It became about them. It wasn't about the country anymore. It wasn't about the well-being of our republic, whether or not our posterity is going to enjoy the same liberties and freedoms that we did when we were growing up as kids, because I guess the 60s kind of ruined it for me. But I had, you know, 10 or 15 years there where I really got to enjoy the liberties and freedoms that, you know, to enjoy. I guess it's not as good as it's been. But the point is, yeah, we've got a big problem with a lot of groups. Here's for example, one that just I really want to pry over because they have such a golden opportunity, the Tea Party. Okay, I'm in Sacramento getting the Tea Party going. It didn't really have what to do with it does now. What it meant was taxed enough already. That's what TEA meant. And so I helped get that organization going. They're doing pretty good there. All of a sudden, the leadership, supposedly, they started fragmenting, and it became an issue of personalities over purpose. And then here we're stuck with, you know, people doing these little petty little things. Well, I'm not gonna belong to you anymore. I'm gonna unfriend you and whatever. You know, you're sitting there trying to talk to people and say, listen, we have to do this right. We're Americans. Our founding fathers. We believe in certain principles in this country. You know, a lot of people have died to ensure those principles. And we have to do things by, you know, according to Hoyle and the way is written, and forget about getting out there and starting a war. If you can't even get enough people to get out there and attempt to, you know, get somebody elected that therefore can start the process, because it's going to be a long process to get things back to where normal again.
You know, John, you're right about that. Except that I don't think it's going to take nearly as long as other people do. I think that once
some
we unleash liberty,
yeah,
I think it'll be very
quick. I don't disagree
but
with you. I don't.
Have to say that anybody who thinks that they have all the answers or that they have the only answer is clearly mistaken.
Right.
Look, if I didn't have so many patriots with so many different views offering me their 2 cents, I would be far poorer of point of view. What I urge people to do is kind of what I'm doing. Now, I'm not an officer or a member of any organization at all. However, I work with every organization and individual I can in every aspect of the liberty fight if I can help them, because I can't do a lot of stuff. I'm not a numbers guy. I'm not a video guy. I'm not a social network. There's a lot of skills that are required, organizational skills. I'm good at what I'm good at, and I can help people with that. But if they share devotion to be simple things, to restoring the constitutional limits and unleashing liberty, I'll work with them, period, if I can help them move it forward. What I've been urging groups to do is to protect their mailing lists, protect their donor lists, stay on message, whatever that message is. It doesn't matter what your particular focus, what your heart is about. If it's for the Constitution, it's a help. We have no way of knowing exactly which fight is going to be straw that breaks the camel, break through the defenses, or gain what support or viral. But what I've been urging to not criticize the other group if they're not doing it for Second of all,
no.
When another group has an event, an action point, they're sponsoring legislation, they're trying to get signatures, whatever the heck it is, they're holding signs up on an overpass, they're training in the woods with AR-15s, what they're doing, pass the information to the other people. As a person who's going to be running for the president of the United States, you're going to have some sort of coattails. There's going to be other races where
yep.
you can help them simply by mentioning them, by bringing them up on the dais, by saying, here is somebody who does not necessarily view everything exactly the same way I do. We may have disagreements, but when it comes to the core principles, when it comes to integrity of purpose and integrity of character, this person is someone who, at this point, I can endorse, I can say is with me. And if they'll say that for you, then you have just not only doubled your followers, and so have
absolutely.
They, but it's actually geometric.
Yeah.
Nothing succeeds
Reagan,
like success.
Right. Yeah, Ronald Reagan said, you know, don't fight your fellow Republican. You know, unite. Show, the accolade that they deserve, or point the thing that they're doing right, the things that you agree with, the things that you don't, that you're working together, and all that kind of stuff. I understand that. I do that within my own campaign quite
That's
a bit.
Good.
Like I was saying earlier, I had to go through all that ego fighting and inside bickering, and we finally figured out what that magic key was, and that was to make everybody all inclusive in the thing and understand that we all aren't going to agree on everything, but that we had parameters that we all had to agree by to cooperate amongst each other. And as we would, we would go about, onto a common goal, even though we might not all agree with each other, because I don't expect everybody to agree with everything I say. I'll tell you that right now. I got a wife tearing me across the side of the bed right now.
Well, you know what?
And I'm hurt to death. What's that?
What it's going to require is something bigger than just the Republicans not fighting each other. It's going to – half the country thinks they're Democrats. Half the country thinks they're Republicans. They're not necessarily either, but – it's going to require a reminder, a redefinition, a modern version of, in modern idiom, because the founder's language, while it's inspiring,
have you seen it?
Yeah, sort of dated back, talking like you did in the 1790s. Remind people of what Americans are. When I was a kid, and I'm probably older than you, I don't know, I'm 53, but when I was a kid, there were still Republicans. Okay, well, then you're a little older than me.
Yeah.
There were Republicans and there were Democrats. There were innocent. But disagree and debate vehemently on specific details of news and stay not only cordial and friendly, but more than that, they could remain united as Americans on American issues, on things that we all agree on, and we need to all
Absolutely.
Agree on certain things.
Yeah.
The most basic
yeah.
of those is restoration of constitutional limits on government.
Right. My slogan,
yes,
my banner, my whole thing that I'm fighting for,
you and I can
is
agree on everything.
Yeah, mine is restoration of the Constitution to its original form and intent, and I consider myself a constitutional conservative. Okay? That's what I consider myself. Not a Republican, not a Democrat.
Very good.
I'm an American. I keep on telling people, put a hyphen between your name. You're an American. You're not an African-American. You're not a Mexican-American. You're not an Asian-American. You're an American.
I agree with
okay,
that.
We're all fighting for the same thing. We're fighting for the existence of this republic. And if we don't all get together and start fighting for this republic, then we're going to lose it. And I fight that out on a daily basis. And I'm getting better at getting that point across. I mean, I don't know. I don't think I've talked to your group before, but yeah, I've done a lot of speeches to where I explain that fact to people exactly what you're talking about. Exactly. I mean, it's a truism. It's something that it's something you can't really argue against because it's the truth. And that's the way people have to act if we're going to make any progress at all in getting to the end game, and that's reclaiming our republic. And if
you know
we don't,
something,
we're
sir,
not going to do
I think that you know, we can, I'm even willing to work and do work with constitutional liberals.
Sure.
They're more and more of them. People who have realized on the left that, you know, that they have the government solution is not a solution. It's statism. It's going to get them progress that they want. And that the Kool-Aid is tainted with cyanide. Basically, this has been what the founders designed was a system where there would be a constant tug of war within a very stable framework where things would not change too quickly, where it would take care of things as was required, between the conservatives who would pull back and say, wait, now let's not lose everything that we worked so hard for. Let's save the best of what we have. And the liberals who would say, no, we want to push further into the new untapped potentials of what we might be able to do. And both of them are valid viewpoints within that constitutional framework. And we end up with a system where until the progressives realized how to get over on us and how to subvert everything, we had retained the best of what we had. And we were slowly but gradually and inexorably changing those things. We dealt with and got rid of slavery. Then, you know, today I work with people of all colors and all races and all national backgrounds and, you know, every different sexual orientation, I suppose. And the thing about it is, if they're Americans who have respect for me and for themselves, if they work hard, if they're decent to each other, if they have something to contribute, I don't have a problem with any of that, and they don't have a problem with me. They don't look at me and say, oh, you're a white guy. Oh, you're a Polish guy. Oh, you're an old guy. You know? No, they say, here's an American guy who is positive, who's trying to help me out, and who's not trying to hurt me. You know, quite frankly, most of my life, to accept those people who at least did no harm to others. But at this point, I don't think that's acceptable. I don't think it's acceptable to sit out the fight. As Reverend Niemöller said, and this may be a bit dramatic because they have not actually activated the FEMA camps and nobody's being rounded up at this point.
That's right.
But he said that when they came for whatever group it was that wasn't his, he didn't say anything. And by the time they got to him,
there
was
nobody
left.
They came after me.
There
was nobody left. But speaking of not much left, gentlemen and ladies, there is not much time left, unfortunately, for the show. Time definitely flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, actually, we're just about right at the end of my voice. I've got about a 2.5 to 3-hour voice limit, to be honest with you.
And so what we're going to do is what we do here on the show is we'll give each a couple of minutes to close things out before I need to shut things down for the show. And what I would like to do is, which I usually give deference to the ladies, is Tessa, you're still out there, give you a couple minutes for your final thoughts, and then we'll each about 2 minutes, folks, if we would. And then to you, Dan, then, of course, we will end the 2 minutes with you, John. And thank you very much for spending as much time as you did on the phone, on the line. We really enjoyed our call tonight. So go ahead, Tessa.
Great.
You can, give us some parting words tonight.
Who are you asking, Bob?
Tessa? Are you still there? I see you on the line, but...
I heard a female voice in the background. She may be maybe arguing with one of her seven, her children or something.
And maybe we had some audio. I know past a couple weeks we've had some audio going on, and I'm definitely going to make a call on that tomorrow.
Let me tell you what, coming at us hot and hard over that, guys. Trust me, I've had my computers tapped. I've gone down to my telephone carrier. NSA has my telephone tapped. I already know I'm at the top of the list of the NSA right now because of what I've got going against Barack Obama. And I don't care. I, you know, enough people know me. If
they're going to shoot me, go ahead, kill me. You know, I got too much to fight for, and I'm going to stick to it till the bitter end. I've got 58 wonderful years of being in this country, and I got to ensure that my children get what they get. You know, they get their fair share. So that's the way it goes.
Dan, if you want to say, yep, looks like Tessa's call did drop, unfortunately. So, Dan, if you got something for a couple minutes, and then we'll bring it back over to you, John, and then I'll close things out.
Okay.
Okay. What I would like to say, first of all, is about that NSA list that Glenn Greenwald is about to publish. He's teasing us. I cannot wait to see who's on the list. I know my friends will be on there. I'm hoping I'm on the list, and I'm hoping I've been working really, really, really hard to rise on that list to be as big a problem to the statists as possible, because I am no enemy of the state. I am an enemy of the statists. Now,
yep.
You mentioned fighting to the bitter end, and I've said this publicly. While I would much prefer to live to my 80s or 90s and die peacefully in my sleep, in my bed, at home, with no illness, surrounded by loved ones, whatever happens, I've led my life, and this is not for me anymore. This is for our children, for the next generation.
That's right.
Right. Now, folks, you've had an opportunity tonight to listen to John Dumais, and what he says rings true. He knows what he's thinking about. It's early on. Presidential campaigns don't generally start this early. We're still working on 2014. However, this is a very good opportunity for you to vet a candidate, find out where this candidate stands, check further. If what he says rings true with you, as it did with me, then what you're going to want to do is go to his website, and you're going to read more. Then you're going to want to Google and see what has happened, and you're going to want to vet his words as I would ask you to vet my words. Check and see. When someone tells you something, do not assume that it's true. Do not assume it's not true. Do the research. It's easy these days. The Internet makes it easy. And you'll probably see some spurious reports, some crazy stuff, and that'll tell you something too. But now you have a person who has stood up, the first person I'm aware of, who besides Hillary, who is not officially, announced her candidacy for Crypt Keeper or whatever office she's actually trying to go for. Please,
with the Crypt Keeper.
Yeah, please look further into John Dumais' candidacy. What he's offering you is a commitment to the Constitution, and he's proven it because he's done it already, and he didn't give up, even though he didn't win. He took 7 electoral votes, folks. 7 electoral votes is more electoral votes than anybody else got except those 2 major candidates. And that means that there's people out there that this resonated with. And this year and next year and the year after, these are the years where we're going to have to do everything it takes. Sitting on the sidelines is no longer acceptable. And you're going to have to choose a side and stand up on your feet. You can't allow anyone else to do it for you or assume it'll be done. Otherwise, you're going to have to consequence that, and it won't necessarily be one that you like.
Yeah, I appreciate those kind words, and I couldn't agree with you more. The whole point is that everybody must make sure that they exercise their franchise, because when you absolutely refuse to do it, then they're just going to assume that you don't want to exercise your franchise anymore, and you're not going to get that opportunity to vote, and then before you know it, there'll be whatever swastika or whatever they're walking around with, jackbooted thugs and everybody else, and your freedom and liberties are going to be out the window, and you're going to think that those things that you think are automatic and like liberties and freedoms and not paid for by the blood of people that actually went out there and died at very young ages, and some not so young, but to get where we are in this country right now, you've got to get off off your tush and get up there and do something. Just look, it doesn't take big money.
All people have to do is get out there by word of mouth. Thank God we've got the communication systems that we have right now through the laws of 6 degrees of separation. We know everybody, and, I mean, we can get to anybody, and we can tell anybody everything that we know. And I'm just sitting out there, and I'm offering up to do the best that I can to right the wrongs and to set this, you know, nation back on a straight and narrow course again and get things going back the way they were. And that's by restoring the Constitution and the way it's supposed to be ran. Yeah, I say it's going to take a while. And, you know, like I can tell you my first 100 days, it's going to be a whirlwind. But, you know, after that, there's going to be a big fight in getting back to normal again. And nothing worth fighting for, you know, comes overnight. And it's worth fighting for. So we're get ready for the long haul, and I'm going to be there. The way I look at it, I got 2016. I'll have another 4 years after that, and if I take good care of myself, I'll be right about Ronald Reagan's age when he get elected. So I'm still going to be there, and I'm going to still be fighting the good fight and doing everything I can. I appreciate you guys giving me the time, and I like to tell everybody, you know, to take care. You know, God bless you all, and you know, and may God keep you all safe, and hopefully we'll persevere, and we'll manage to come out of this all smelling like a rose. I think things are done on purpose, and you know, in this universe, and I think our time for testing has happened now, and it's time for all of us to stand up and be accounted.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you very much for coming on to the show and of course, spending as much time with us as you did. We really appreciate it. We'll definitely be watching your campaign, and as things progress, we'll definitely like to invite you back onto the show.
Yeah, send them that way. It's very easy, right? An actual campaign site. Like I said, we're a grassroots organization. I do have some very good people, talented people, know what they're doing, but like I said, we're working slow and hard, and we got started early because we knew that we were behind the eight ball, and we have to get in front of the eight ball so we can get into a pocket. So, anyway, to get a hold of me on Facebook, all you have to do is type my name. There's I think there's 560,000 references to my name on the internet. So all you have to do is type in D-U-M-M-E-T-T, and you're going to get my Facebook site, no problem. I'll come up first, you know how that goes with Facebook. And the actual campaign website is D as in dog, U as in umbrella, M as in Mary, M as in Mary, E as in Edward, T as in Tom, T as in Tom, 2016.com. And when you get there,
are you a junior, sir?
Yeah, I'm a junior.
Albert?
And
there you
another
are.
Thing, yeah. And here you
oh,
go.
Man,
you would, you're not going to miss me. And another thing, you did mention your lineage. Well, we got something else in common. My grandfather was Chinowsky, and we lost some family members in the ovens too. So. I definitely understand what's going on. I'm a Christian, but that's neither here nor there. But the point is that we're not going to let that happen again.
Is it's happened in so many countries and so many places for so many ideologies that were fake that it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or Christian or any other religion. It doesn't matter if you're from a particular ethnic group or an economic group. People like Stalin and Mao and Hitler and Pol Pot and even crazy Idi Amin, they had their way because the people lost control of the government, and government becomes very paranoid and uses its power. There is no group in this world that has not been victimized. There is no individual who does not have ancestors who were treated as slaves or a little better than slaves wherever they came from. This is America. This is the one place where we established a system that if we only adhered to it, we could actually live free.
And with that, Jason,
actually freedom. Yeah, actual freedom. You got it.
Say that again.
Yeah,
and direct folks.
I just said at this point, yeah, I'm going to have to say goodnight or we're going to be cut off in mid-sentence.
All
right. Well, so,
goodnight, but just be sure to sign up. That's all I got to say. I need the help. All righty?
Definitely. Check
all
out
right.
His website.
Thank you very much, guys. God bless. See you later.
There. You too. Take care.
You too.
And also check us out next Wednesday when we will have Peter Greenwald on, as well as, well, we're still working on it, but we got a shot at also getting Mr. Dave Bratt on, who recently beat Cantor in the primary election there in Virginia. So we'll be looking forward to having Peter on and perhaps Dave as well. And so I will end tonight as I do every night, and that is with the song by Aubrey Ashburn. So thank you, everyone, and please share the link with people that you know, either through email or Facebook or Twitter. And so good night and take care. And, of course, you can hear more of Aubrey Ashburn's music by going to www.aubreyashburn.com. So as we say, take care and good night.